All right, I'll call the meeting to order. If you are here, please check in on the computer. All right, we have 30 board members present. That is a quorum. Let's continue with the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right, under the Chair's report, the first thing I have is the WCA convention update, and I didn't tell her I was going to do this, but I wanted to call on Arlene to see if there are enough people signed up to help you with that, if you need more volunteers, if there's things they should be doing at this point.
I was in Madison yesterday, and I did go to WCA office to talk to Cheryl, and she's going to email me some things to see what she wants me to take care of and what kind of help we need.
Okay.
So I haven't had my computer on yet, but she is going to send it.
Sounds good. What I'll do is put this on again next month, and if anybody's interested in helping out, the convention, as you know, is here this year, and need a lot of people to assist in that. And WCA folks do the groundwork, but our folks are real important too. So
yes.
If you're interested, talk to Arlene, and we'll keep bugging people.
Thank you.
Thank you. And next up, Day in the Life of Jill Billings.
Thank you. This is an event that the Health and Human Services Board and staff does every year. This year it's on June 16th. I believe supervisors received a letter notifying them of this opportunity. In the health department, we're offering a tour of the laboratory, which is always interesting. You can observe a public health nurse. There a tour of Cooley Region Humane Society, several other options, and Human Services is this year is highlighting services that will at least will be cut back this year, in all probability because of the budget, and so we'll all be voting on that. So this is your opportunity to take a preview of the services that you'll be asked to make tough decisions on. It includes a home visit for a child in need of protection, a court hearing with initial assessment worker, intake and economic support, so you can see firsthand how the economy is affecting people in La Crosse County. They start at 8:30 in the morning at various times through the day. We have sign-up sheets in the outer room, and I believe it's at 3 o'clock we're having a debriefing back here where everybody can talk about what they saw and any comments that they may have. Thank you. I encourage everybody to sign up.
Anybody have any questions for Jill on that? Okay, Jill, when we get to the very end, if you remind people again to sign up, I'd appreciate that. I have an announcement. If you are interested in attending the WASC convention or conference on June 15th and 16th, you have the green sheet on your desk talks about it. What is real important is to coordinate your registration through the chair's office. Talk to Margaret up there. The deadline is tomorrow, so if you are interested, call the chair's office tomorrow, and Margaret will take care of getting you signed up. That's starting Monday evening, June 15th. There's dinner and auction. And again, contact the chair's office if you're interested. That gets us to supervisor conference reports. Anybody have any? Jerry Sobranek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the 12th, 13th, and 14th of this month, the Southwest ICBET attended the Northern Networks Conference up in Duluth. It was very educational, very informative, as always. It was Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Canada, and we had a great time with those people. No boat rides, no free beer, and no cost to the county. And on the Tuesday here, I attended the Senior Citizens Day at Carroll Heights there. The lunch was excellent. Pete Eitz spoke, and then the main speaker was Kelly Kramer, and she did an excellent job, and we had a good turnout there. Thank you.
You made it sound like it was surprising that there were no calls to the police for that. Is that the norm that you guys get in trouble when you do that, Jerry? We'll leave that as
I'm taking the fifth.
We could leave that for the next report.
I like to phone a friend.
Don Mina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have a conference report, but I've got a series of books on the Driftless area, which is the area from Minneapolis to the Illinois border where the glacier did not go over. There, the reports are in a box right in front of you, Steve. So those are the Driftless area comments, and I hope everybody takes one, including the news media, if they want one.
It looks like this box was cut by Jerry's friends after they went to their conference. Other conference reports, Arlene.
Thank you. I also attended the Northern Network in Duluth, and just wanted to share a couple things here. Canada is the U.S. largest overall trading partner. Over $1 billion is the total daily trade between Canada and the U.S. Canada is the top market for U.S. agricultural exports. In May of 2010, the next conference will be in Fort Frances, Canada. We have a strong partnership with Canada. My next one is Wisconsin County Highway Association, Capital Days in Madison, which was Monday and Tuesday of this week. The federal highway funds have been cut in half. In Washington, D.C., they talk of raising gas tax 11 cents. Wisconsin Department of Transportation will have cut in their services, such as wayside closing and having volunteers staff these. No trash pickup along the interstate. No more right-of-ways, only once in the spring. They plan on volunteers to do this. We visited these offices in the capital, Schilling, Hipsch, Kopanke, Nearson. After reading today's paper, it is a waiting game about how many days these cuts in the state could go. And it was a very nice article, Steve, whoever wrote that, and everything is true in there. And I found out all that stuff when I was in Madison. And last but not least, I was in Michigan, and not for the county. I was there visiting my daughter. They have 100 state troopers will be laid off and will not be called back at the end of June. Also, in 1 in 10 homes are in foreclosure in western Michigan, including Cadillac, where my daughter lives, but she still has her house. So there's tough times. Also, when I was, I should say, in Madison, it's the toughest budget that we've ever been through. So everybody is trying to work with everybody to get it going. Thank you.
Thank you. Brad Paff?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a quick question for Arlene. Did the Wisconsin County's Highway Administration talk about the federal stimulus dollars is coming back for the DOT in order to assist the State Department of Transportation in some of their budgetary issues that they have? Because there is federal stimulus dollars that is coming back to the state, and it is. I know that it is something that the state does appreciate.
Yes. Also, we had meetings with the DOT, and they're still working on their budget. They gave us nothing. Every question that was asked, they said they have not discussed it yet. It's still coming. So we have no idea where we're going to get the money yet until they tell us. And they have the money, they just don't tell us where it's going yet. Thank you.
Other conference reports, Vicki Burke.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think Supervisor Ebert attended several of these conference sessions as well. The Association of Public Safety Communication Officers held their North Central conference here from April 26th to the 29th. And several of our county staff, Al Blanco, Keith Butler, Karen Hole, Nancy Hemke, Jay Leffler, and Mike Thompson worked on the conference committee. I had the opportunity to attend a couple of the sessions, and it was certainly well done, and I appreciated it. Also, we had a group from the county that gave one of the sessions on crisis negotiations related to the Shoot standoff. So it was an interesting conference, and I think that it was great to have it in La Crosse since it's usually held in much larger venues.
Thank you. Jeff Schrader.
This is some fun stuff that doesn't even pertain to the county board, although we did sign a resolution or pass a resolution supporting the Freedom Flight. Over Father's Day weekend, there are several things going on. Freedom Fest is going on at La Crosse in conjunction with the Freedom Flight, and there's a memorial for is generating money for La Crosse for the stadium out here for the veterans there. And the there's a big article printed in Visitors Magazine. There are flyers out there for Freedom Fest and also for the Freedom Honor Flight. Freedom Honor Flight leaves and returns June 20th from the airport. And there's a large party at the Colgan Air Hangar that night. So anyone that can attend that to honor these guys that are coming back on this flight, they very much appreciate it. It's a highlight of their life going to Washington, D.C. to see those monuments.
Good. Thank you for that update. Other conference reports? Maureen Friedland, I'm going to ask you to mention, it's not a conference report, but can you talk about the forum on treatment alternatives that's coming up?
Oh, yes, certainly. AMOS is a faith-based coalition in La Crosse comprised presently of 13 religious congregations, and we are looking at a variety of issues in town, Hmong issues, hunger issues, health care, and one of the issues that we're concerned about is the issue of treatment instead of prison. And we're sponsoring a forum on the 27th, that's Wednesday, to talk about ways of keeping people out of jail and essentially doing the kinds of things that La Crosse County is very involved in right now already. Judge Elliot Levine will be one of the speakers, Jane Claycamp. We're going to have someone who is coming, a graduate of one of the different treatment programs. I'm not sure whether it's alcohol or drugs yet. And we're also bringing in the State Department of Corrections coordinator, Rick Ramish, who's going to talk about some different measures that are pending in Madison, including earned early release. So I pass this out to everyone because I think this is really very relevant to the work that we're doing, and I think it's also important to know that there are community organizations that support the kind of work that the county board is already doing now. Thank you.
Thank you. That's next Wednesday, the 27th, 6:30 at Trinity Lutheran Church at 1010 Sill Street. One other thing that is coming up is there's a WCA educational seminar entitled Energy Independent Communities, Second Quarterly Meeting. That's going to be the end of June, Monday, June 29th, from 10 to 3 in Stevens Point at the Holiday Inn there. There'll be nominations for WCA Second Vice President, presidential appointments to the WCA Board of Directors, steering committee nominations, but also talking about the energy independent communities. So if you're interested in that, talk to the chair's office. Again, that's Monday, June 29th from 10 to 3 at the Holiday Inn in Stevens Point. Jeff Schrader.
When are all the applications due for what you were just talking about?
They might be overdue at this point. Bridget, we sent one in for you. Do you remember that? Wasn't the deadline? Oh, it's not till August?
That's what I thought.
Oh, okay, well, I thought it was early. Okay.
That meeting's in June, so it must be before that.
Yeah, because I thought, Bridget, we got yours in, like, right shortly before it was due. I'm not sure, but call up to the chair's office, and Margaret can put a call into WCA and ask them. Anybody who's interested in any of the steering committees, let me know. We'll get you signed up.
Well, I will. Also, I forgot to mention that French Island Days is Father's Day weekend also. So there's lots going on in French Island.
Be there or be square. All right, Administrator Report, Steve O'Malley.
I have a number of things, but just while we're talking about meeting dates, I noticed an error on the committee schedule, miscommunication in my office. Public Works and Infrastructure Committee, just a reminder, we're going to meet on June 15th. which is a Monday at 4 o'clock. That's to allow a number of members that are going to the Highway Committee meeting on the 8th. So if you are planning to attend that or otherwise, please make that note. We will not be meeting on our usual time, June 8th. Next, I've got a list of items to update you on. I'll try to be as brief as possible, but the information on the state budget was actually just finalized in the last half an hour. The governor's press conference, along with the co-chairs, Pocan and Miller, just outlined their next level of cuts for the $1.6 billion next level of staff impacts on the state legislature. I'll briefly go through it, but we still need to analyze what the entire impact will be on La Crosse County and our budget. The majority of the cuts are to state agencies and to school aides and shared revenues of almost $670 million. Furloughs and cutbacks of state worker pay raises is about $224 million. Reestimates of the Medicaid hospital assessment, expanding and counting more on that, is about $165 million. The 911 fee, remember I told you that Jennifer Schilling had helped spearhead the ability to have an additional surcharge on cell phones and landlines to help counties with the capital costs and private providers with the capital costs of 911 provision of services. That $100 million will not go to counties. It will end up going to the general fund of the state budget. So we'll still increase the cost to phone owners, but it won't help us deal with our costs. It'll maintain current level of tax credits and certain tax collections that will generate about 185. In other words, that some of the new tax credits they were going to talk about will not be instituted. That will generate $185 million, and they'll end up doing some state debt restructuring for about $285. It's only just as recent as the last half an hour, so I don't know the additional impact for us. But what it does recognize is that they're trying to come to a conclusion on what's happening with this budget. You will probably follow over the next several days. The Joint Finance will be going into session Friday, Saturday, and probably Memorial Day as well. They're going to be trying to bang out this agreement in the next several days. So we are continuing to monitor it. I coincidentally will be on vacation next week, but I'll also be monitoring this and in touch with our lobbyists throughout this situation, trying to protect us as best we can, but recognize that with this level of impact, it's going to be very, very difficult for us to have a lot of change that's there. I want you to know what your staff is doing to prepare you for recommendations that will be coming back through the process. Again, we're not going to have any kind of knee-jerk reaction, but we're going to systematically bring you back recommendations because we do have some time to deal with this. Recognize that when I say that, it's a reminder that our budget calendar is different than the state's. If and when they adopt this budget and finalize these issues, they start to impact us July 1st. Their budget, of course, is a split calendar biennium. So at this point, we don't have anything guaranteed to go on, but we know the particular areas that they've identified. Specifically in mind with that, at our next Public Works and Infrastructure Committee meeting, your department head and Household Hazardous Waste Coordinator will bring in a series of recommendations on what to deal with the cutback in the Clean Sweep Grant. That will impact us for the entire calendar year. That's about $100,000. It will impact the level of service and how we provide service for household hazardous waste. Hank Cook, your new department head, and Jeff Lloyd have formed a good team to produce a series of recommendations that will come back to you. That will go to the Public Works and Infrastructure Committee and the Executive Committee and County Board next month. We're hitting the high point of their season of when people bring in that material. We don't have a lot of time to work with it, but hopefully you'll be able to guide us on whether or not we've hit the mark right on how to deal with that recommendation. We have to deal with that right away. Secondly, and most importantly, the largest cuts that we know of are in the Human Services Department. They're case-specific. They're to the economic support area, basic community aids for family and children support services, mental health placements, juvenile placements, and a number of other areas. And Jerry Huber and his management team have already rolled up their sleeves and are dealing with identifying ways that we can deal with that impact if we are not successful in getting any assistance from the state to pay for their mandated programs. We will bring you choices and ideas on how to deal with those kinds of things. In addition, and last but not least, I want to touch on a resolution that you will end up having later on coming from exec dealing with a voluntary leave without pay program. You've heard other organizations across the state talk about furloughs, talk about leaves, talk about other types of things. This is our approach to work with employees and ask for their help in addressing this budget situation. Recognize that we will probably have to do more. When we actually determine what the impacts of the budget are and it's clear for you as policymakers and us as managers, we will bring you recommendations and obviously follow your direction on how to deal with this. The Leave Without Pay program that's being proposed, and I'll discuss more when I get there, but I want to make sure you understand this is only for 2009. We may need to do something more significant in 2010, 2011. But it is very, very positive that the conversations we've had with our bargaining units, until we actually ask people to sign up, bargaining unit members, labor negotiators from the union side have been very, very positive. You should know that I volunteered for up to 3 days between now and the end of the year without pay to voluntarily take out of my compensation. And the union president of the downtown AFSCME group, Mary Speltz, has also volunteered to match that. We are attempting to lead by example to ask our employees to help us through this situation. They know that we're going to be in similar straits in 2010. Part of the sign-up will also be to ask them for their interest in will they be willing to help us in the future as well in 2010 and 11. So I think it's a very positive sign. I also want to point out and just kind of mention that a number of us will be asking that if we if employees take time off, that they also, if they have time during that time off, to perhaps do that in public service, and that I'll be organizing a Habitat for Humanity work day on one of my days off in June. I'll send out an email on that. We can only handle 16 people on a site at the time. I've already had a number of department heads that have identified that. I'm going to encourage anybody that there are people in our community that are hurting and being impacted by the downturn in the economy, and if we're able to help the community get through this budget cycle and also do public service, I think that's a good way of showing the community that we lead by example. These will be difficult and challenging times to deal with the budget, but we're committed to minimize the impact on services, provide the services we need to our clients, and at the same time make it through here. There won't be a lot of easy decisions, but recognize that everybody from management, department heads, and now union employees as well have said they'll work together to try to help address this. And we're going to come back to you with recommendations as we go through this. We'll spend more time on that when the Leave Without Pay resolution comes up. But I want you to recognize that we're spending time to stay on top of this as much as we can. And I'm very, very proud of the staff people we have, in particular Jerry Huber and his management team for working very hard to address the specific areas that are there and to bring you recommendations in that regard.
So questions for Steve on the budget before he goes on to the next thing? Chuck Spiker.
I got one big one on shared revenue. Because of the time frame of the state budget, are we going to get hit in 2009? We projected $4 million and almost $5 million. Now, that hit is going to come right away in 2009 because we get paid 15% end of July, 85% the end of November. So are we going to take that hit right away?
We don't know that answer yet. The fact is that if it's whatever the percentage decrease is, it would be for their biennium, but it could potentially impact us worse for 2009. When we know that answer, we'll bring that to you.
Thank you.
Jeff Schrader.
When you mentioned a clean sweep, that's funded for this year, isn't it, for 2009?
It's funded by the tax levy that the villages, towns, and county have provided funding, but the one quarter of that entire program, about $400,000 is the entire program. $100,000, or one quarter of the entire revenue, is from the clean sweep grant that is being eliminated by the governor's budget. So we will have to either make other cuts and adjustments within that budget or find other funding to make up about one quarter of that budget.
Other questions for Steve? Ray Ebert.
Are we or have we considered a hiring freeze to at least stop the bleeding?
We do that on a regular basis. We re-examine each and every position. We don't look for a lot of headlines on it. That's been our standard practice. The difficult part is when you have 24/7, which is a significant part of our operation, and just the delays in hiring anyway, there are attrition savings. So we address that specifically, but we don't make a big deal about it.
Other questions or comments? Okay, keep going, Steve.
Okay, the next item I have, and we don't have a comprehensive solution for every one of your questions, but on your table is a brief response to the questions that you raised about the assisted living. I'll quickly go through them, but again, the purpose is just to keep you up to date. There are no decisions tonight, and when we come back, I'll talk a little bit more about the timeline of when additional information is coming back. These were the six major questions that we understood that folks had, and I just want to make sure that I readdress that the information we're giving you is not slanted or biased in any way. It's actually very conservative, and we're going to continue to refine this as this comes back to you. Number one, the question was asked, is there any way that we can limit or target those in the community that would need affordable housing? Recognize that that's been our entire mission at Hillview. Carroll Heights is a perfect example of that. We will explore with Corporation Council any kind of viable ways legally of dealing with how you give preference to folks that are in need of more affordable senior housing, but recognize that's exactly what Hillview, of course, is that the vast majority of clients that are both there and Carroll Heights are on assistance, are on Medicaid, which means that they are lower income. And the majority of people that come in that are private pay, they end up using their assets and then become qualified for Medicaid. That's generally what's going on. And in fact, Hillview could not survive if it was only Medicaid eligible. What's been attractive to keep the operation going is that about 30% of our clients there are private pay. But over time, the longer that they stay, their assets end up being depleted, and then they will end up qualifying. We will take this question very seriously. We'll pursue what options you have, because I know a number of board members are concerned about that, and we'll try to give you more specific information when that comes back. Number two, this is the work we've been able to do in the last several days since we met with you. These are the discharges not just for 2008, but all the way up to current. You'll notice that approximately 52 discharges. This also gives you a clear indication that the majority of the clients that may be lower or middle income are private pay, but they're only able to be private pay as long as their cost of care can support that. Then eventually when they've used their assets, they end up qualifying for MA or MA Western Wisconsin Cares. So again, we're identifying those areas, and that's the current mix of where people that have discharged from Hillview gone to assisted living within this community and the kinds of pay. In addition, that anecdotally from all of the social workers that work directly with the clients, their first request has always been, from our knowledge, to stay on the Hillview campus if that was an option.
Jeff Schrader had a question.
I can wait till the end, but do these discharges that you're speaking of here now, does that include the people that go in there for rehab that are in there for a week or whatever for on Medicare?
As I understand it, this is only for the folks that are discharged to an assisted living facility that we know of. This is not somebody that's discharged to home or discharged for another reason. This was targeting specifically that type of clientele that's looking for that service. There are more discharges than this is what I'm trying to say. The third question is, what are the risks of not building this assisted living, and what are the risks if we do build and it's not profitable or filled? We're refining our budget numbers. We're meeting with Western Wisconsin Cares to identify the revenue. Maureen Friedland raised a number of questions that we're reexamining within the entire budget, and we'll bring that information back to you because we want to make sure that we don't keep adjusting this, that we give you firm, comfortable numbers based on the latest information in revenue from Western Wisconsin Cares and what we believe the market will set the rate at, and we'll show you what the minimum break-even point is. We thought we were identifying a 15% vacancy, which is a pretty conservative number. We think we'll probably experience a higher occupancy rate, as we have done at both Hillview and Carroll Heights, but we'll give you a number that says, if we don't hit this number, what is the absolute break-even point, and we want to make sure that's the right number, so you see what the risk is and what our fallback is if we don't build the facility. as well as if we do and the numbers don't work out exactly what we said. We want to know what that break-even point is. How we came up with a mix of apartments, Pete described that, and they're working on that right now. You should know, and Roger's been very involved in this, there are a number of design and optional meetings that are coming up, trying to see what the right mix is. Roger is the chair of the Aging Long-Term Care Committee, is being involved in that as much as he'd like on any of those meetings. If you're particularly interested or you're part of the Aging Long-Term Care, we can also make those open to you as well, so just let me know. But we're trying to see what exactly the right mix is. The projection is initially for 24 and maybe 26 and maybe 23. We're going to see what that makes sense, as well as the size. Is it one level? Is it two level? But we're trying to be very responsive to your input on that, and we'll continue to work through that. We're also spending a great deal of time to make sure that we're comfortable with where Western Wisconsin Cares goes in number five, as far as what that projected revenue source is and what those options are, not just currently, but where they're going as far as how they're reimbursing folks. And finally, interdepartmental chargeback and indirect costs. I was surprised that there was questions about this, but let me be very clear and unequivocal that the numbers that we put in there were not indirect costs. Indirect costs are where administration, finance, corporation council will charge to an enterprise fund the cost of indirect support to those entities that end up generating money and saving property tax levy. Interdepartmental chargeback is where an entity like Hillview will recover some costs interdepartmentally from Carroll Heights, or in this case, the assisted living. The accounting difference is significant. During the budget, we'll talk more about and educate the full board again, as we've done other times, on what indirect costs are. Indirect costs never end up recovering all of the costs of the administrative support from other agencies unless there's a federal or state revenue that's able to maximize that. If it's simply shifting tax levy between departments, while we keep track of that information, we don't end up charging back. And in this case, we were not charging anything additional back to Hillview. It was an interdepartmental chargeback between entities at Hillview to help their bottom line. So I sometimes that may sound like a nuance, but it's a critical understanding to know the difference between those two, and I apologize if people didn't immediately pick up on that. So again, the timeline is that at the June 8th Aging Long-Term Care Committee, we will bring more firm data back to that body and get their direction on the next steps, as well as the county board policy planning meeting that evening. We'll bring you information, and if and only if you're prepared to make additional decisions, that could be as early as the June 18th meeting of the county board, or you could set different standards and say we want XYZ before we take the next step, and we'll talk about is this a decision for this calendar year, or is this something that we need to include and evolve more information for you towards the 2010 budget? So again, we continue to try to respond, but we promise to give you back some response to the questions you had. We're going to give you better data on a number of items that we didn't fully address here.
Tom Rauch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to say that question number one at the lead of the front page was particularly important to me as one of my criteria to decide whether I support or not. And quite frankly, reading it, those four bullet points that are there, I think just must be addressing a different subject or something. I don't think they talked to question number one at all. And I'm still looking for a meaningful answer that that shows that we, in fact, can control strongly that word limit and target the needy element that we say we're trying to serve here. Not to describe the needy element that we're already serving in a different facility, but that how we'll make sure it happens in this one. And so those four points for me don't yet answer the question.
And I understand that we may not be able to limit that, but the what we're trying to get across there, and I'm sorry you don't acknowledge what we're trying to say there, is that's exactly what we do. The problem is that people come in as private pay and they become affordable, and we may not be able to, due to discrimination and other things, be able to do that. I'm fully cognizant that that's one of the things you're asking for, and I don't have a better answer. But what Pete felt was that's exactly the track record we have right now with the private services we provide. So I'm sorry that's not as responsive as you wanted. That's the best we could do for tonight.
Ray Ebert.
Thank you. Yeah, just on some of the figures, I talked to Mr. Hyde earlier this week, and he talked about that it would be staffed 36 hours a day from 7 to 7, two people, at 7 at night to 7 in the morning, one person. Well, it's $10.71 an hour times 36 times 365 is $140,729. You show $94,077, and those are the kind of figures that I wasn't that thrilled about last week, and it doesn't appear that we're getting a straight skinny. So I hope that we'll get a much better and a breakout that includes food and insurance and all that stuff. I think this one page was certainly not enough to let us make an intelligent decision. And I think the numbers are a little fuzzy.
Other questions or comments? Maureen Friedland.
Yes, I've asked some questions about these numbers also, in addition to questions about how many hours would be staffed. There are questions such as, what about recreational therapists, the kinds of amenities that make assisted living attractive? But some other questions that I'd like to have answers to. Can we give a preference to Carroll Heights? Can we actually have a specific preference? Most of those people are on Medicaid. They are low income. Can we have a certain number, a target number that we aim for? I'd like to know more about the vacancies and why there are vacancies. It seems to me as if a snapshot in time was taken of a particular day and what vacancies were there. I'd like to know a little bit more about what's happened since then, what their vacancy rate might have been a year earlier. I'm not sure about this correlation.
Vacancies or someone else's vacancies? I wasn't following. I'm sorry.
Well, the chart that we were given last time we met that showed what the vacancy rates were at the different facilities, I believe that was just on one particular day. And I'd like to know more about the whether they're going up, whether they're going down. I question some of these, whether those numbers were typical of that particular time. The correlation has been made that the vacancy rate has to do with cost, but I don't follow that correlation completely. For example, Eagle Crest is the most expensive facility in town, and it has a very low vacancy rate. Meadowood presently has a very high vacancy rate, but it's also the oldest facility, or one of the oldest facilities in town, so maybe that's really the factor that's going on. So I'd really like to know a little bit more information about why the vacancy rates are as they are before I can look at this and see something meaningful. I'd like to know a little bit more about the Whipfley study that we paid, $10,000 for, $12,000 for, I've been told. That was a study that was paid for out of the Carroll Heights funds, and the conclusions were that the assisted living field is getting rather crowded, and I think that study was done a year ago, and there may be some new facilities since then, and also that more dementia units were needed in town. That's the direction we should go in. So I'd like really more information as to why we're discounting that study and not accepting it and saying that it's problematic. And lastly, the statement that you made that people use up their assets and then they become eligible for Medicaid and for family care. I agree with you that's what happens, but I think that when we're talking about discharges, unless we know that that's going to happen in 3 months or in 4 years or in 7 years, we can't just say that that's going to happen, and therefore we should make our decisions based on that happening. These people who are being discharged to assisted living, some of them may only be staying for rehab purposes for a month. Others may be looking for a place to live for 5 or 10 years. So I'd like to figure out how that depletion of assets factor kind of really factors in here, really works in here.
Ralph Gary.
Thank you. Everybody's focusing on this this facility. I've got a question. Maybe Pete and Gary can just rough this out for the next time we meet. If Hillview's average census drops 20 for the year, what impact did that have on their budget? This facility is about 24, and I'm assuming about 90% of them would go to Hillview if they didn't reach end of life in that facility or something. But if Hillview census would have dropped 20, let's say in 2008, just rough out some numbers, what would it have done to the bottom line? You know, we'd lost X amount of revenue, and we could have made some adjustments on expenses, but I'm thinking it had a dramatic impact on what that bottom line looked like. So the next time we meet, you don't have to be exact, just rough something out, would you?
Anybody else? Joe Veenstra.
This is kind of complicating it a little bit, but I think one of the things that's difficult to people get their hands around is that just because someone qualifies for medical assistance doesn't mean necessarily that they are historically poor. If you have a good lawyer, you can do a lot to estate plan and avoid having to pay a dime, and you still qualify for medical assistance, and your family is probably wealthy. You've done a good job planning for your retirement. So I think it's kind of a... I think it's a real complicated thing. It's not something simple. And I also think that sometimes people might qualify for certain types of assistance if they're discharged from a hospital, for example, for a number of days, where they'd be eligible for 100 days for MA, and then they start to have to pay privately. And it's just a lot more complicated than just is on a piece of paper like this. I think we have to somewhat... I think we need to find out a little bit more underneath the individuals that are discharged, for example, where are they? Are they? I guess, is there something more we can get than just they qualify? I don't know.
Well, we'll raise that issue, but again, we're well versed in the eligibility standards of how you qualify for Medicaid, Medicare. I mean, that's a whole process. What I hear you suggesting, though I don't think it's really what you want, is how do you evaluate the economic standards of the person either prior to that or their family? And I don't know how you would do that, let alone that anyone would have to comply with that. But we'll raise the issue, I guess. It's we don't bring you a lot of easy questions. We bring you the issues, and we try to do the best we can.
Anybody else?
Your
previous message is brought to you by Johns Flaherty and Collins SC.
Just remember, your back is to him.
Okay, let's go on to Park Plaza.
Mr. Doyle and I have met with Water Place One, who was the party that has responded to the RFP. I don't have a great deal to report because, quite frankly, the difficulty in coming to any kind of a recommendation or agreement is being affected by the economy. The ability of developers to be able to project, being able to do a successful development in this economy is really being challenged. What is marketable? What is possible? And I still am cautiously optimistic that later on this year we'll be able to bring you a recommendation, but we may not be able to come to an agreement again because of the current economy. We'll continue to work on that. I stay in regular touch with Mr. Doyle with the few contacts that we've had with Water Place One. Mr. Shepard's been a great help with that, but I wish I had more news, but this too is being impacted by our economy.
And we'd really like to do something on this, but we're not going to give it away either. I mean, so we're trying to be responsible in that regard. Jeff Schrader.
What's being stored on the property now, or what's sitting there? Is it just dirt and?
Well, the Bikini Yacht Club is still operating each summer, and we just redid that contract, so
right.
they're there.
Go ahead with your.
Well, they're partly on our property. And
right.
Partly on theirs.
And they're responsible for maintaining the whole area? Is that correct?
Well, to the extent that it can be maintained. Jim, you have anything to add on that? Okay. Anybody, anything there, Jim, besides Bikini Yacht Club? We're not storing anything, right? I didn't think so. Okay.
Well, you know, there's a lot of people are looking for garden space in town, especially with the economy the way it is.
That's not black dirt. That's, you're not going to grow anything there.
Well, I don't know. I don't know whether it is or not. It's probably just sand, but sand, when you water it, grows.
The last crop there didn't last real long. We had to cut it down.
Pardon?
The last crop didn't last real long. We had to cut it down. It was a hotel.
Boo.
Okay, keep going, Steve. Well, I was assuming you, at some point, you were going to introduce the new department head.
Oh, we didn't list that, but yes.
Well, John Menninger's not here, so we're not going to get in trouble for straying from the agenda. Quick, before he shows up.
Yes, before I turn this over to Gary on the financial matters, if Hank Cook would please come in, I'll introduce him. He wasn't able to make the last meeting where we actually made the recommendation for hiring. Hank, if you want to come on in and just say a couple words and introduce you to our board of directors, the County Board of Supervisors, who we work for.
People will recall Hank as the guy who gets really, really excited about solid waste. So.
And now I have more reason to, because I'm working for a really good system. So I'm just very pleased to be here. I'm very humbled that you chose me to be your new director, and I'm looking forward to working with the county and helping you become a great system and provide the best in service.
Welcome aboard.
Thank you.
And you'll notice that the guy with the biggest smile in the room is Denny Osgood.
But our thanks to Denny for the great job. Doubled his duties and didn't add a nickel to his pay, unfortunately. Sorry, Denny. All right. Gary is up to talk about sales tax and finance update.
I'd like to talk just very briefly about two schedules, one of which was included in your packet, and then the other one was handed out this evening. The schedule that was included in your packet was a sales tax schedule. It's a 9 to 10 year history of sales tax in La Crosse County. The part I'd like to just briefly talk about is to the far right side. We have only received 2 months of revenue for 2009, keeping in mind that the sales tax proceeds for January came to us in late March. February's came to us in late April, which is standard procedure for the state. You will notice that the first 2 months of 2009 are less than 2008. They are also a little bit less than 2007, but they are above 2006 proceeds. The same way for February, they too are less than 08 and 07. Excuse me. January's proceeds were actually 84% of January of 08. February's proceeds were better. They were 96.6% of 2008. In total for the 2 months, we're running at about 90% of what we were for 08. We're running at about 99% of what we are for 07. So hopefully they'll continue to, come in close to what we received for 2008. We did budget $9,725,000. We received last year $9,804,000, or about $79,500 excess. The bottom the bottom row all the way across shows the excess that we received each year. I didn't total that all the way across, but just for your information, over the last 9 years, we received $5,359,000 in excess over what we budgeted. We have actually applied about $3 million of that over the years, so our balance right now in excess sales tax revenue is $2,350,000. Any questions on that schedule?
Questions, Jeff Schrader.
How many departments are affected by the excess sales tax?
Well, by the excess, by the excess.
Okay, how many departments use excess sales tax?
For 2009, I think it was just the economic development budget that we applied excess sales tax to.
Okay, and how much did we?
We applied about $300,000.
Thank you.
Don Mina.
Well, if I read this graph right, Gary, you're projecting $1,350,000 for the total for this year?
No, that's what we've received in total so far this year.
Oh, I see.
For January and February.
Because if you were going to go up that high, I think you're blowing smoke. Because, okay, I got you.
I try not to do that.
I would agree, and usually you don't. Yeah. That's why I...
Sure.
Okay, I got to look at the second line. All right. And that might be high, too, because the economy is not good, and it's not going to take off for a while yet.
Probably not.
Other questions? Ralph Geary.
Thank you. Gary, is anybody's bond rating be affected by this downturn in the economy? I think La Crosse County is pretty solid, but are you aware of any other counties or anything that's bond rating or may get affected by this downturn?
I'm not aware of any. And actually, that leads me in, I guess, to the next schedule, if I could. The other schedule that I'd like to talk about is the blue one that I passed out tonight. It summarizes for you on both sides the fund balances for our funds here at La Crosse County. I would like to mention that it is unaudited. We closed the books in March of this year. The auditors have about completed their field work, so that's why I wanted to get this to you right now. We don't think there's going to be any significant changes that the auditors are going to make going forward, so I wanted to get this information out to you. Overall, there aren't any surprises here. A couple of things to highlight. The general fund actually it decreased substantially from 2007, but that was intentional. We took $3.5 million by resolution last year and put it into an interest rate stabilization fund, knowing that the interest rates on investments had gone down significantly throughout the year. Of that $3.5 million that we set aside from general fund, we used about $850,000 of that for 2008 to supplement what we had received. So we still have $2.5 million in the interest rate stabilization fund that we can use going forward for this year and future years. As far as the special revenue funds, surprisingly, even though some went up a little bit, some went down a little bit. The total of the special revenue funds for 2008 fund balance was $11.7 million. In the end of 2007, it was $11.6 million. So overall, again, some went up, some went down, but pretty much held steady. And turning around to the other side of the sheet, as far as enterprise funds, they went down just a little bit. But that is due to solid waste. As you probably remember, we had planned on borrowing for some of the construction projects, but due to the fact that we had a fair amount in their undesignated fund balance, we actually took from their fund balance to fund some projects. So even in the enterprise funds, except for solid waste, actually all the other enterprise funds increased in fund balance. So bottom line, there are no surprises. Those that did go down, we did it either by budget or we had planned for the reductions. You'll get more summary information and additional information when the auditors make their presentation in a couple months.
Gary, to kind of restate what you were saying, your impression then is there's nothing here that would lead to a change in our bond rating.
That's correct. And that's, apologize, thanks for reminding me. The bond ratings are very much, decided upon what your fund balances are. The current economic conditions of the region are very important, but I'd say, 50% of what we're rated on is based upon our fund balances, and frankly, they're looking very stable.
Brad Paff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gary, going back to the sales tax revenue comparison month by month, U.S. Federal Reserve claims that the, quote, recession began in December of 2007. Looking at our numbers for 2008, 6 months met or exceeded the 2007 numbers. And I guess my question to you is, can we dig deeper than just this? I guess I'm wondering, where are these revenues coming from? Are they coming from, obviously, retail, but what part of our county retail is strong and what part of our county retail is weak? And the American consumer, all we know is that, quote, we're in this bad recession and things are terrible and it's doom and gloom. And I guess I'm trying to know, obviously something is happening, and it's happening in La Crosse County in 2008, and these numbers in 2009 aren't where we want them to be, but they're at 90% of 2008. So could you tell us?
Well, the only answer I guess that I could give you off the top of my head is one reason why we have a good bond rating other than our fund balances is because we have a very diversified economy here.
That's right.
In La Crosse County. Our La Crosse County almost always tends to lag unemployment rate for state, and certainly it lags, or it's lower, I should say, than what the national average is. So I can try to get more specific information from the state in regard to if there are strong sectors or weaker sectors, and possibly Mr. Brockmiller could add some additional information.
I would appreciate that. Sure. Thank you, Gary.
I would imagine Bill probably can add something to that.
Well, thank you. Part of what I was going to say is that indeed, the recession, as I think most, if everyone knows, as Brad said, was called by the group that's charged with determining it in December of 07, but Wisconsin, and particularly La Crosse, didn't see any evidence of a recession until the third quarter of 08. Our unemployment rates for the first half of 08 were just as low as they were in 07 and 06. Employment in this area kept increasing until the third quarter of 08, whereas national employment started to go down. And the reason why they called the national recession in December of 07 was that was the first month where for employment totals went down nationally, and they've been going down ever since. One way to put it would be we didn't join in that bad party until the third quarter of 08. It's pretty good that we're, because you could say the local recession didn't start until the third quarter of 08, so it's pretty good that we're, all things considered, that we're around 90% of that first half of 08.
Bill, we lag going into it. Does that mean that we're likely to lag coming out of it too? Is that historically what we've seen?
Well, it's hard to tell for sure. The more the different diversified parts of the economy perform, the quicker we'll come out of it. As it's nationally and here, it's as the last few recessions have, but this one more than ever have hit manufacturing the most. I mean, for instance, for us, those of us who know things about places like Janesville, Wausau, and Racine, where they were so heavily dependent on manufacturing, I think they're gonna be in it a lot longer than we are. The clinical definition of a recession nationally will probably end around the third quarter of this year, meaning the nation as a whole will start to show some positive gross national product growth. However, employment gains always lag that, both nationally and locally. So, and a lot of our budget is based on how employees are doing, you know, workers, our county residents. So that will take, unfortunately, that we won't see, in my estimation, that kind of recovery this year. The other thing, among Wisconsin's 12 metro areas, La Crosse is the lowest unemployment rate. It's around double last year, but it's, you know, some areas, including Janesville and Racine, are almost near triple. So that was
okay.
My
thank
observation.
You. Thank you, Bill. Also, Steve, help me on this. The SEDS report comes out, is that once a year? And when does that come out? Brad, I think, is that LADCO or MMRPC, the SEDS report? That'll have a lot of the questions that you were asking about will be in that report. Yeah. Okay. Anybody else have any questions or comments on this? Okay. Is that it for you, Steve? Oh, I'm sorry, Jim Burns. I didn't see you over there.
Thank
sorry.
You, Mr. Chair. Gary, quick question on the
undesignated fund balances sheet that you passed out. When you said that we were going to take $3.5 million into put into an interest stabilization fund, is that still a fund, an undesignated fund? Is that on this sheet?
No, it's not. If you look at the 2008 undesignated fund balance for the general fund, it's 13.1 million.
Yep.
At the end of 2007, it was 16.9 million. So we've taken the 3.5 out of undesignated and put it into a reserve.
Okay. Is the intention then to return that money back into the undesignated fund, or put it back into, or what's the intention of the now $2.5 million?
The intention, I guess, as you know, as the original resolution stated, is that if the interest rates continue to stay low, we're going to need to supplement interest earnings revenue. Keep in mind that the county ordinance states that the general fund undesignated fund balance should be somewhere between 40% to 50%. It had grown to about 58% during 2008, again, which was part of our rationale for setting aside that money. I don't think we have any intention of replenishing that because we're still at 44%, but that would be up to the county board.
Okay, so right now it's just going to stay in the fund indefinitely?
Indefinitely, and we will draw from that if we come up short on interest earnings.
Okay, okay, thank you.
Anybody else? Okay, cards and correspondence on the board over there, including a thank you note from Mr. Geary and Ralph. On behalf of the board, we certainly offer our sympathy in the death of your mother. Tom Ralk, if you could take the chair.
Extra appointments, Chairman Doyle.
Thank you. I have two appointments to the Criminal Justice Management Council, Tina Weirs and Jeeva Thole.
And is that a motion?
Would be.
Okay, and second was by Vicki Burke. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you very much. Okay, the consent agenda, is there a motion on that? Moved by Roger Plesch, a second by Jerry Sobranek. Any questions or comments on the consent agenda? All in favor say aye. Opposed, no. Carried unanimously, and that gets us to planning, resources, and development. Mr. Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have item 4-5, zoning petition number 1810, filed by John Rundell, doing business with Rundell Ranch LTD, to rezone from exclusive agriculture to Agricultural District A in the town of Greenfield. This petition passed unanimously by the committee. However, you note on there that it does not become effective until the zoning deed restrictions are filed, and that will become effective at that. So I move for your approval.
Mr. Meyer moves the committee report, which is to approve subject to that being filed, seconded by Dennis Monti. Any questions or comments on this one? All in favor say aye. Opposed, no. Carried unanimously.
Item 5-5.
Don, can you back up away from the microphone just a little bit?
Okay. Item 5-5, conditional use permit number 793, filed by Ralph Gunderson for Gunderson doing business as Gunnard Gunderson, to grow, sell plants in two existing greenhouses as proposed greenhouses on 3,286 acres of land privately owned, and it want to rezone it from. It's currently zoned residential District A and Agriculture District A. We had a long discussion on this at the meeting, and I'll move for your approval with the 10 conditions. I think the big condition on there is that it's only for 1 year, and then we'll see how things go, and you'll have to reapply again. So I move for your approval.
Okay, the motion is to approve the committee report, which is to approve the conditional use permit for a period of 1 year, subject to the 10 conditions that are listed in the minutes, seconded by Bob Kyle. Questions or comments? Maureen Friedland?
I have a question about this 1 year.
It seems like that 1 year would be somewhat artificial. I'm wondering if 1 year is enough to really prove anything. If business could be just low for any number of reasons during that first year, and then the situation looks different than it really will be for the neighborhood. I'm wondering if it's possible if the Planning Resources and Development Committee isn't satisfied that 1 year is long enough, that it could be a second year. Can that be done procedurally?
Everyone is satisfied with that 1 year will be it. Even the man applying for the petition, he does want to find out how it's going to work before he goes too far into the business. So it was discussed, as you say, Maureen, about 1 year, but everybody was happy with it.
Marilyn Pedretti?
Just for the record, there were two of us who voted against this, and it's not a unanimous. It was Mr. Meyer and myself voted against it.
Tom Rauch?
That's right.
Thank you. And my recollection is that PR&D committee chose to impose the one-year limit. In fact, we even talked about whether it should have been end of calendar year or 12 months from date of approval. And we went with 12 months from date of approval because that's a condition that the town of Shelby had already imposed from its perspective. And so, in fact, if we had offered longer, the town of Shelby still had that limitation imposed. And so we just went with what they had asked for.
Don Vina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to say the same as Tom did, but we did have a couple of neighbors there who were concerned about the amount of traffic going in and out of there, and they agreed. They would have been opposed to it, except they agreed to it if we reconsidered it in a year. That would allow them to see the traffic that goes in and out of that road, and nobody was opposed to it except for a couple of guys on the committee at that point in time.
You'll have to obviously apply long before 1 year if he's really going to stay in business. You can't wait till a year from now to do it and then expect to do business next year.
Okay. Jeff Schrader.
Thank you. Does that mean, does he have to pay fees?
Yes.
Again?
Go through the whole process again, right?
Correct.
Okay. When you go back through your minutes, you might want to change the number of acres that are involved. I think in the minutes it said 3,000 and some. Is that right, or is it one on the...
Isn't it more like, is it 3,000 or is it 32.86?
Yeah.
I think that's more likely it. Leon Paff.
Jeff is not there.
Thank you. I was just wondering, if he puts up this future house area, number 5, if it's not renewed, will he have to tear that down?
Yes.
I mean, there's expense there, or how is that going to work? And also, I was just wondering, what was the reason that the two voted against it?
Okay, I'm going to ask Jeff Blusky to come in to answer the first question, and then the people who voted against it can give their rationale for it. But, Jeff, you heard the question about the building. Would that have to come down?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, there's two greenhouses right there already listed at number 4. Mr. Gunderson had indicated that because of this condition, he does not plan to build the third one for the first year. So actually, he's been running a business up there for quite some time now, but he's been taking the things to different shows and stuff. This is the first time he wanted to actually sell plants on this piece of property. So... he kind of agreed to that too for the first year, just to see if he'd get any clients, because currently he does have some clients. He's going to mail to them because he can't put up any signs. He lives in the subdivision that you have to drive through to get back to this new business, so he's concerned too about the traffic that is going to be generated there. So this is kind of a trial thing for him to supplement his income.
You still have the floor.
Did that answer the questionnaire? If he'd number 5, a future bowl greenhouse, 35 by 100, is also granted on the same side of the road. If you pull it, if he builds it, the next year you pull it, must he take that down?
No, he could still use it just like he's been using the other two.
Okay, he doesn't have to tear that one.
No, he can still grow plants in it and take them off-site and sell them at the YMCA or wherever.
Mm-hmm. Fred Conkle. Mm-hmm.
I just had a question wondering why he can't put signage up. Wouldn't it be in the business's best interest to do that?
The county is very sensitive with where signs go, because if you don't own the property, you just can't plop a sign, and you can't put a sign within our right-of-ways either. So people still do that, but we make a lot of phone calls to tell them to go take them down, because there's absolutely nothing supposed to be within the county's right-of-way or town right-of-ways of roads.
Okay.
Okay?
He can have a sign on his property, though?
No. No
nothing.
Signage.
No signage. Okay.
So how will people know that they're in the right place?
Address.
Yeah. He's just going to advertise through the mail.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Jeff Schrader.
It's not like he's... Oh, no. Go to Jeff.
Jeff Schrader.
Thank you. Jeff, as long as you're up there, follow up on what Leon asked about removing the building, and then if you go down to number 8, does that need to be in there then?
Number 8 was for the parking lot. He didn't really realize that he'd have to have a parking lot. Now, you know, it's real hard to picture this piece of property. It's got a real long private driveway that leads back to where Mr. Gunderson lives, not the applicant. And it's real grassy, and it kind of slopes downhill a little bit. And, you know, sometimes people don't think far enough ahead, but if he does get some customers that come up there and they park and it rains and people, you know, slide down the hill or something like this, all we indicated was if he feels like he has to construct a parking area, that if he decides that he's not going to run the business up there, that he's got to put it back. This was more for his father than for him.
Okay, then.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps that the point that Leon was making there, that the building, that should be added in there, that this would not have to be removed, because he would be disturbing, according to number 8 there, for the purpose that is stated.
He can still keep the third. He can keep the greenhouse at number 5 if he wants to. He doesn't have to tear that down.
Okay, so maybe that should be pointed out in number 8 then, because according to that, he'd have to repair everything that he had done to it if the business failed.
This, yeah, if you wanted to clarify that and just add something for the parking lot.
I'm not on the committee. That's
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get that clarified. I think that raises a legitimate question. You mm-hmm. don't want to have an issue to come up months from now in terms of what you're saying. He's probably not going to do it, but if he would build that building, that can stay. So if number 8 would read, if this business fails for any reason, the areas disturbed for business use should be put back to their original condition, and maybe we could add, with the exception that the bow-type greenhouse may remain.
Yes.
Okay, somebody want to make that as an amendment? Okay, Jeff Schrader, seconded by Brad Conkle. Any discussion on that? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried unanimously. Okay, we got that taken care of. Brad, I saw your hand up again, I think.
I was just wondering what requirements are there for the parking lot, for the as far as the structure of that. Does it have to be blacktop, or can it be gravel?
It could be graveled, and he knows that, yes.
Other questions or comments? Jill Billings.
I believe that Supervisor Leon Papp's second question wasn't addressed regarding the two no votes.
They were kind of shy, so let's see if they'll step forward and explain themselves. Don Meyer or Marilyn Pedretti, either of you want to...
Well, first off, I've never had to justify a vote here before like this, and but my reason...
I don't think they're asking for justification, just
well, sure
wondering...
He is.
Where
you, sure he is. He wants to know why I voted no.
Yes, that's not the same as asking for justification. Hmm. You may persuade him, I think, is what he's saying.
I think that's lawyer talk, but go
it
ahead.
It is.
I voted no.
As Mr. Veenstra said, we have lots of good lawyers in this town.
I think I voted Veenstra. Mainly the traffic situation is the only thing I had about it. I think the neighbors were, you know, they weren't really adamant against it. They were there to get information that night, so it was not a real tough public hearing.
Okay. Marilyn?
That was my concern, the traffic and the road that leads into it is very narrow, and the neighbors weren't exactly thrilled with it, and I thought, well, vote against it.
Okay. Other questions or comments? Jim Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a correction on the report from the committee. It says it's by unanimous vote, and it should really be by a vote of 5-2.
Okay. That should be changed. Yeah. The record will reflect that.
We'll correct that. So I move for approval as amended.
Any further questions or discussion? All in favor, say aye. Aye. Opposed, no. The noes, please raise your hand. They are Chuck Spiker, Brad Conkle, Marilyn Pedretti, Jill Billings. Mr. Meyer, are you voting against it again?
Yeah.
Okay. That passes.
Thank you.
Moving right along. We have the items 6-5, 7-5, and 8-5. They're all for termination. I move for your approval as a group to terminate all of them.
Anybody object to handling all three of those together? Those are pretty much housekeeping things. Okay, the motion is to approve all three of those terminations, 6-5, 7-5, and 8-5, seconded by Don Bina. Questions or comments on that? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried unanimously. That it for you, Mr. Meyer?
That's it.
Thank you, sir. Executive Committee, Tom Rauch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have item 9-5 regarding approval of a development master plan for La Crosse County Farm. Whereas Schreiber Anderson Associates was retained in 2007 to complete the master plan process for the approximately 370-acre county farm site and surrounding village properties located north of I-90 and adjacent to the existing business park. And whereas preparation of the master plan was a public process with input from the county staff and Village of West Salem staff, key stakeholders, village trustees, the Planning, Resource, and Development Committee, Economic Development Fund, County Board, and the general public. And whereas the master plan for the West Salem neighborhood development includes the following 15 features, and, or I should say the listed 15 features, and whereas full development of the master plan could take 15 to 20 years, starting with the initial development near the East Tilson Street and East Garland Street intersection, including some mixed-use commercial development. And whereas the Village of West Salem was mailed a copy of the county's proposed master plan on March 24, 2009, and it is recognized that neither the West Salem Planning Commission nor the West Salem Village Board has held a public hearing on the master plan nor given it any sort of approval or disapproval, and that the county recognizes any implementation of the master plan will require West Salem Village Board approval. And whereas the La Crosse County Economic Development Fund recommends that the county board approve the master plan and proceed with the implementation strategy identified in the plan as provided in future county budgets, now therefore be resolved that the La Crosse County Board does hereby approve the development master plan for the La Crosse County Farm dated February 2009 that was prepared by Schreiber Anderson Associates, subject to the approvals of the Village of West Salem and or its Planning Commission as required by the Village Code of Ordinances. Be it further resolved that the implementation of the master plan may proceed subject to the availability of funding approved by the County Board in future budgets and approvals required by the Village of West Salem Code of Ordinances. Fiscal note, there is no fiscal impact for 2009, and the implementation costs for 2010 and beyond will be in the discretion of the County Board and may be determined in future budgets. I move its approval.
Moved by Mr. Rauch. Is there a second? Seconded by Don Meyer. Brad Paff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question I have is, right now, this property is leased to a farmer, correct?
Portions of it.
Portions of it.
That lease can be terminated upon reasonably short notice.
Okay.
Although we don't expect
that. We would more than likely have to do it before the spring planting of any given year.
I think it would be fair to say that he's going to be planting crops for a fairly good long time before we start terminating that. What we've been doing, though, as it goes along, is as we've been chipping away, as you know, we've extended that road a little bit at a time, and that's how much of this would continue to go. We're not just going to wake up someday and say, we're done, and now we're going to put houses and everything there.
Fair enough. Thank you.
Okay. Don Vina.
Well, I guess I don't know if it's ethical or not, but the mayor of West Salem is sitting on our board as a county board member also. I haven't heard
anything. He's pretty ethical.
I haven't heard. Well, you didn't hear my question yet.
I thought you were asking if he's an ethical guy.
I guess I would kind of like to know, since part of this is in the city and part of it is in the county, whether or not
it's all in the village.
Okay. Then I would like to know from the mayor of West Salem whether or not this is an agreeable situation or not, because I asked the question only because we formed an economic committee of four municipalities out in that general area, and it fell apart after we approved it. And I'd like to have approval by all entities prior to the county doing something, but if the mayor says it's okay, then I guess I would go along with it.
They don't have a mayor. They have a village president, but let's hear from him.
The village president says, you're referring to two totally separate entities. The thing you talk about with other political parties getting together is different land, different part of the township, has nothing to do with the county farm. The county farm is all in the village. I have had review of this ordinance, resolution, a number of times, and at the last meeting of the county development committee, there was some significant changes made. We got rid of the reference to something called a third downtown property. There's no way the village would ever consider having another downtown in the village. We have two now. We don't need a third. We also changed some other wording referring to having only access to a future developments by something called alleys. The village does not service alleys, probably never will, and so that part of what's in here will probably change before it's done. That's why you have strong reference that it's the village board and its planning commission to review anything before it happens. But we've got rid of some of the objectionable language called third downtowns and some other things. And this was brought up at the Economic Development Committee, also reviewed by our legal counsel, and we all agreed we can sign on to this because there's a lot more meetings to be done in the next, 15 to 20 years?
And as we've said all along, this is a partnership.
Right.
Neither the village nor the county is going to do this on their own. We're going to do it together.
Right.
Okay, and that was my concern. If the village had some serious reservations, I've got a copy of the original plan, but I haven't got a revised copy of the original plan. And many changes, or some changes, were made. That's why it would be nice for me to know what those changes might be.
Well, there's the maps up there for anybody that wants to take a look.
I'll probably look at them later.
Yeah. Okay. Jeff Schrader, did I see your hand up?
Yeah, just for information, if you were to implement the plan today, what would that cost? What costs are entailed in that plan?
The easiest way to respond is it depends on what stages. You couldn't do it overnight. It depends on the market. How much would be done in conjunction with the developer? Who would be the developer? What would be our role? What's the role of, are all of these public streets, or are they part of a private development? There are any number of ways. One of the ways to deal with the alley question is they may not even be an issue for the village. They may be operated and owned by the homeowners association. There may be any number of ways to do this. So we don't have a good answer. That will be the specific details as we phase this in, as we work with the village and the market changes for housing.
Other questions? Mr. Ebert.
Yes, as far as they talk about costs in 2010, if we pass this, can we just put this to bed until there actually is some agreement between it seems that this always comes up and we just keep rehashing this over and over again. I'm just wondering if some point we can quit spending money on this until we get closer to development. If you're talking 15 to 20 years, it just seems we're spending a lot of time and a lot of resources on it.
The fiscal note is to try to be clear that there is no impact and the only budget you can deal with is 2009. If something were to be proposed for 2010, you would have to vote on it. We have no intention as staff to, at this point, we haven't even started working on the 2010 budget. So,
But we did feel it was important to get it this far, because keep in mind, as that business park keeps growing, it's going to have some impact in terms of what the rest of that development looks like, and we wanted to make sure everything was done harmoniously, if you will. So now that we have a very broad brush type of blueprint here, as we're continuing developing that business park north, you know, it goes from the heavy industrial to lighter and then ultimately commercial and then the residential. We wanted to make sure everything made sense. So having this in place today doesn't mean we're going to spend a dollar on it, but people who are bringing in businesses or talking about bringing in businesses can look at what the rest of the scenario looks like. That's why. And, but I think at this point we're done spending money for a while, except for expanding the business park.
Okay, and expanding the business park in what's already plotted as business.
I Correct.
There was some talk about increasing the amount of business or about of commercial property and stuff, so that's apparently off the table now?
What you see on the map is what the current plan is. Keep in mind, of course, plans can change. I mean, if somebody came in and said, you know, we got a gazillion-dollar development, what would you think? The board can vote on it and could change it if you chose to, but this is where we're at today.
Thank you, sir.
Sure. Other questions or comments? All right. Mr. Geary?
Well, at some point, are we going to have a planning meeting on this 6 months from now, a year before we... When this thing was brought in originally, I understand where West Salem's coming from. They don't want three downtowns, but one of their selling points is, oh, they can walk to work, they can walk to the shops. It was all designed a certain way, and as West Salem makes changes, does this actually change things for us?
I think it would be fair to say that the general idea has not changed substantially. What it would probably be accurate to say that we've more tweaked than anything, not wholesale changes. What you saw a few months ago, that general idea is still there. It's conformed more to what the village says is acceptable, but it's still basically the idea that this board said, yeah, that's the route we want to go. Would you agree, Dennis? Okay. Steve, anything to add on that? Okay. Anybody else have any questions or comments? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried unanimously.
Mr. Chair, I have item 10-5 regarding adoption of contract with the Deputy Sheriff's Association, whereas La Crosse County and the Deputy Sheriff's Association have been bargaining for a successor contract for the period of 2009-2010, whereas the parties have reached tentative agreement on all issues raised through collective bargaining. Now, therefore, be resolved that the tentative agreements of the parties be adopted as changes to the contract for years 2009-2010 effective as specified in the agreement, including across-the-board wage increases of 2% January, 1% July of each year of the contract, pending ratification by the union membership. Be it further resolved that the county board chair, county administrator, and personnel director are authorized to sign the collective bargaining agreement as amended upon approval of the corporation council. Be it further resolved that the personnel and finance departments are authorized and directed to take such action as is necessary to put said working agreements into effect and carry out the intent of this resolution. Fiscal note, the estimated increase in costs of wage, fringe benefits, and roll-ups for 2009 is $65,678, a package increase over 2008 of approximately 3.09%, of which 0.91% is insurance, and for 2010, $63,633, a package increase over 2009 projected of approximately 2.91%, of which 0.89% is insurance, for which contingency funding was budgeted. There are approximately 29 employees in this bargaining unit. I move its approval.
Moved by Tom Rourke, second by Vicki Burke. Any questions or comments? Maureen Friedland.
I have a question. I'm curious about the part that addresses drug copays. It says that they must be filled by mail order, and I guess that the reason for this is because it's probably cheaper in many cases to do mail order for drugs, but doesn't that cut against our local businesses and hospitals and companies, pharmacies here to do that? What?
I'm going to ask Bob Taunt to come in and respond to that. Bob, could you hear the question?
Yeah. The mail order portion of this really is not new. We had the mail order in the previous contract, but this was recommended, and I think most plans today have the option for mail order for long-term drugs. it's very convenient service. It saves money. I don't know how to evaluate whether that cuts into local business, but there's enough drugs of other kinds that can still be filled locally. But this is something that all the insurance consultants recommend that we do.
So in other words, you don't have to do it by mail, but
no.
You get a better deal if you want to go that route.
That's
it's
right.
An option.
That's right.
Okay. Other questions or comments? Jeff Schrader.
Can they get a 90-day supply locally, or can they only get it through mail order?
No, they can get a 90-day supply locally, but if they order through the mail, they can get a 100-day supply for the same price.
Okay.
So there's a little bit of incentive.
Anybody else? Mr. Eber, okay. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried unanimously.
Mr. Chair, I have item 11-5 regarding voluntary leave without pay program for 2009, the program that Mr. O'Malley mentioned previously. Whereas our state and nation are experiencing economic downturn that is more severe and challenging than any of the previous recessions of the past 60 years, and whereas if approved as presented, 2009 to 2011 proposed state budget includes substantial cuts to county funding, representing a major cost shift to local property taxpayers in the areas of greatest need, youth aids, economic support, the cost of mental health and juvenile placements, basic county allocation for children and family services, and nursing home service to the poor, and whereas the impact of these and other proposed cuts combined with a state-imposed 3% property tax freeze will not enable the county to maintain funding to pay for the rising cost of service, and whereas many public and private employers, including cities and counties across the nation, are using time off without pay or furloughs as a means for employees to forestall more severe economic impacts and help their organizations through these difficult economic times, now therefore be it resolved that La Crosse County Board approves the recommendation of the county administrator to offer a voluntary leave without pay program to encourage all county employees to consider taking at least one day, but no more than 3 days off without pay by the end of 2009 to help the county with the budgetary challenges threatening the ability of the county to maintain current services. Be it further resolved that the time off without pay is not required of any employee, may only be approved at the discretion of the department head, in part to ensure that the leave does not cause increased costs, and that the county administrator will report total savings results to the county board by the end of 2009 to better evaluate if continuation or expansion of the program in 2010 is appropriate. Fiscal note, if every county employee that works during normal business hours voluntarily agrees to take 1 day off without pay, it would save over $120,000. This does not include 24-hour, 7-day operations. I move its approval.
Moved by Mr. Rauch, second by Andrea Richmond. Questions on this one or comments? Seeing none, all in favor? Oh, Mr. Ebert.
Yes, I just noticed Corporation Council didn't recommend review or whatever. Is there a reason?
At the time that this was circulating, I was out of town.
Other questions? Maureen Friedland.
I have a little bit of a concern about publicity or publication of names of people who may or may not. I have a little bit of concern that people who may choose not to do this because of some financial or economic situation in their own home not be, you know, in some way ostracized or criticized for not being a team player or something like that. Is there a way to protect this information unless an employee chooses to let that information be known?
Actually, that was a significant discussion among department heads and union employees, and we've stressed very strongly that this is not about judgment. If someone is in an economic situation that they can't afford to do that, or maybe their spouse or partner had their hours cut back or lost their job. This should not be used by any means as peer pressure. It's something that we're asking people to do voluntarily. Technically, as I understand it, if someone requires or requests a personnel record, it would be able to be public, but we have no intention of producing a list of who participated and who didn't. We expect to give you information about totals, but there are certain laws requiring what information is public. We have no interest in producing a list like that, and we'll not do that. And in addition to that, we've been very clear with the bargaining units this isn't about peer pressure. It's about people working together and not making judgments about each other's financial situation and doing the best we can, because someone may volunteer today and 2 months from now, when they were planning to take the 3 days off, their spouse lost their job. That's not our need. What we're asking for is participation, for employees working together to make a sacrifice and to see if that works. It's worked in other entities that I've worked for and other colleagues that have used it in other counties and cities, and it hasn't been a big issue about the confidentiality.
Okay, thank you.
I would like to expound upon that. On your desk is a sheet for county board members to sign if you are interested in participating. We had some discussion in terms of how we would handle this, and we decided against a sign-up sheet that would be passed around where you could see who on the county board has signed up and who has not signed up. Again, this whole peer pressure and, are you a good guy or bad guy for signing up or not signing up. So if you are interested in participating, fill this out, turn that into Linda, and we'll enter it into the system. But it's also not our intention to publish a list of which county board members have signed up or which ones have not signed up. Maureen.
Can I ask another question? My head is spinning with the possibilities. I'm wondering if it might be considered, you all might consider it at a later time, something maybe regarding county board supervisors anyway who aren't getting a whole lot of pay. I understand that Sharon Hampson figured it out to, what, 35 cents an hour, something like that, if you figure it over the whole year. But might that there be a way also to deduct some of our actual pay and to contribute to some of the agencies, organizations that we support that may be losing money down the line? Maybe some creative thinking might be a way of kind of organizing us generally to do a day or two for those kind of groups as budgets get cut. Just an idea.
Bill, you want to follow up on that?
I did some research on how U.S. county board members could participate in this program. And
yes, Bill had me a little annoyed at the beginning of the week.
I know I did. My job is just to tell you what the law is. You make the judgment on what you want to do. So,
his initial conclusion was that we could not do this. And to his credit and Gary's credit, they came up with a way that we can do this.
There is a rather odd law, and I think you're also seeing a little bit in on the state level where legislatures have to come up with a way of giving back their salaries. There is a specific law that says you can refuse a portion of your salary or all of your salary for that matter, but you can only do it at very specific times. One of those times is already passed, and that's within 30 days of when you were certified as an elected official, or elected officer, actually. The second time that you can refuse salary is within 30 days of your taxable year, or prior to 30 days of your taxable year. So prior to December 1st of this year, you could refuse all or a portion of your salary for 2010. Again, after election takes place in April, you could do it at that time also for the balance of the year. But certainly for 2009 is what this program is all about. And because of this law, the only way that you can participate for 2009 is to make a charitable contribution back to the county. In other words, your entire salary will be shown on your W-2 as income to you. You can make a charitable contribution, and finance department has a letter from the IRS saying that a contribution to the county is tax deductible as long as it's used for a public purpose, and certainly that's what you do, is you know all of your expenditures are for a public purpose. So if you itemize deductions for 2009, you can take it listed on your itemized deduction schedule just as you would to the United Way or whatever other organizations that you give to. So the only difficulty with 2009, if you don't happen to itemize deductions, then you can't take it. You get the standard deduction whether or not you give anything back to the county or not. So that's a situation for 2009. In 2010, as I mentioned, you can refuse a portion of your salary, and that could be deducted from your W-2 for that taxable year. So if anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to
answer. Jeff Schrader.
I think it was Steve O'Malley made mention of volunteering time to different organizations. Can that be figured into this? Or is that just mentioned, or is it in kind? How could you figure that in as a donation? Can that be figured in?
I don't think for tax purposes, donation of time gets you anything. I don't. Yeah. It's only money.
Yeah, I believe that's correct.
But Steve will keep you posted as to what day or days those are that are available if you want to just do it to be a good citizen.
If I could just make one further comment, there are some different rules for the electeds, the sheriff, the county clerk, and what have you. You know, they basically have to do what I mentioned for you in 2009. There is no refusal of salary provision for them. For employees, any leave without pay can be deducted from their total salary. So. It just depends on what group you fit in as to the rules that apply.
Other questions or comments? Don Meyer?
So if we sign up for this, what happens?
Your check will be a little bit lighter in the month that you have listed there. That's basically it. Okay. Anybody else? Okay. The resolution, we kind of sidelined a little bit as to how it specifically applies to county board members, but the resolution applies across the board to various employees. So if there's no further discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried unanimously. Legislative Committee, Ann Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Item 12/5, a resolution regarding support of film and video production in La Crosse County. Whereas film and video production industries are encouraged to come to the state of Wisconsin by the passage of Wisconsin Statute 560.206, which provides for film production tax credits, and whereas film and video production in the area can be very significant for the purpose of economic development and promotion of the image of La Crosse County, and whereas providing local resources and inducements to film and video production companies is desirable as a means to promote film and video production within La Crosse County and the region of Western Wisconsin, and whereas the Film Commission of Western Wisconsin has organized under the auspices of the Pump House Regional Arts Center, Inc., to be a single source of support to location scouts and production houses. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the La Crosse County Board does hereby support reasonable accommodation to assist motion picture, video, and television production companies. Be it further resolved that the La Crosse County Board may develop appropriate policies and any necessary legislation to support the intent of this resolution. Be it further resolved that the copy of the resolution will be sent to the La Crosse area legislators and the governor. Fiscal note, this resolution shall not preclude La Crosse County from reaching agreements with film and video production companies to charge for extra county staff or use of equipment or services that they request. It passed unanimously in committee, and I move for its approval.
Moved by Ann Fisher, second by Vicki Burke. Discussion? Ralph Geary.
Thank you. I've never quite seen a fiscal note like that. Is in a nutshell, is this there will be no cost to La Crosse County? Is that the fiscal note?
That's correct.
Okay, maybe it should have said that somewhere in there. Normally it says something about cost, and this kind of said we'd charge back or something, but there's no cost to the county.
Vicki Burke.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This was a resolution brought forward to the county board. A similar resolution will be brought forward to the La Crosse City Council. I'm your representative on the City of La Crosse Arts Board, which was recently formed by the City of La Crosse. The reason why the fiscal note reads as it does is because at times when film companies are in a particular region, they may need to close a street or do something like that that would require cooperation. And that's what all the resolution is indicating, is that we would support it. As you know, I believe it was taken out of the governor's budget, but the Joint Finance Committee did put it back into the budget, and so it's a resolution that would support it in that way. And that's my understanding is to the fiscal note being written in that way.
Other discussion? Joe Bilskemper.
Yeah, Mr. Malley, I don't know for sure, but I'm recalling that the legislature, or either the governor, wanted to repeal that tax credit.
That's
because
right.
of the experience with the Johnny Depp film, Public Enemy.
That's right. The governor's budget includes repeal of that. That's what Supervisor Burke was just referring to, is that the Convention and Visitors Bureau, as well as the arts community across the state, has been lobbying to, if you need to modify it, but not eliminate it entirely, that there are positive benefits to promoting the state for film production, and that people within that industry, and particularly tourism, our own local folks felt that it was a bit of an overreaction, that they could modify it and still have it be successful. And this attempts to put La Crosse County and the city on the side of saying, let's see if there's some way to retain that.
Thank you for that.
Anybody else? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed no. Carried unanimously. That it for you, Ms. Fisher?
Yes.
Thank you very much. And Chuck Spiker, Public Works and Infrastructure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have item 13-5. It was approved by the Public Works Committee on a 3-1 vote, approved by the Executive Committee on a 3-1 vote. And it takes 2/3 vote of the County Board, 24 members, to pass the resolution. Authorization to repair floor and administrative center. Whereas La Crosse County Administrative Center was built in 1964 and occupied in 1965, between 1965 and 1997, a garage located in the south end of the Administrative Center was used by the Sheriff's Department as an unloading area for jail inmates. Whereas over the years, the vehicles used in the garage left salt on the floor that soaked into the concrete and deteriorated the rebar supports with the concrete to the extent that the floor is in imminent danger of caving into the basement of the Administration Center. Whereas the collapse of the garage floor would cause substantial damage to electrical system, computer system, phone communications within the county because of a conduit containing such utilities that located beneath the floor, there would be immediate health risk to all occupants and visitors of the building if the floor collapsed due to asbestos coating on steel beams becoming airborne. Whereas it estimated that a full and permanent replacement of the floor would be at the cost of greater than $350,000, whereas the facilities director estimates the cost of the temporary fix that would prevent the floor from caving in is between $150,000 and $200,000, but that the total cost would not exceed $200,000, and this would give the county enough time in the future to evaluate the use, repair, or replacement of the administrative center on a permanent basis, whereas the repair of the garage floor in the south end of the administration center is public emergency in which the public health or welfare of the county is in danger. Whereas the facilities director recommends the county board declare a repair of the floor to be an emergency and that the authority be granted to contract with Markin and Johnson immediate response abatement to do the necessary repairs to protect the health and safety of officials, county employees, visitors using the administration center, and the public that rely on electrical computer communication systems located in the facilities. Now, therefore, be resolved that La Crosse County Board does hereby declare that the repair of the garage floor located in the south end of the Administration Center is an emergency and pursuant to Wisconsin Statute 5952 sub 29 sub B, in which the public health or welfare of the county is endangered if the garage floor would collapse. Be further resolved that the necessary repairs the garage floor shall be on time and material basis, and that the total repair cost shall not exceed $200,000. And the auditor finance director is authorized to transfer necessary funds for the project from the undesignated general fund. Be it further resolved that as a result of such declared emergency, the county and or facility director are hereby authorized to proceed with repairs to the garage floor immediately by the contractor with Mark and Johnson, immediate response abatement to do the necessary work. Fiscal note, the estimate of the project cost between $150,000 and $200,000 on the time material basis was general cost not to exceed $200,000, and with the funds to be transferred from the undesignated general fund. I move for approval, Mr. Chairman.
Moved by Mr. Spiker, seconded by Andrea Richmond. Tom Roque.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're a little unfamiliar with this. I'd like to make a motion for a substitute amendment, which is included in your packet, listed as item 13A, and if I get a second, I'll read the parts that are changed.
Second by Terry Johnson.
Thank you. The two parts that are changed will be the only parts that I'll read into the record are the seventh whereas paragraph, third from the bottom on the front page. Whereas the facilities director recommends that the county board declare the repair of the floor to be an emergency, and the authority be granted to receive quotes from area contractors to do the necessary repairs on a time and material not to exceed basis to protect the health and safety of officials, county employees, visitors using the administrative center, and the public that rely on the electrical, computer, and communication systems located in the facility. And then on the second page, the be it further resolved paragraph that says that as a result of such declared emergency, the county administrator and facilities director are hereby authorized to proceed with requesting quotes for the repairs to the garage floor from area contractors on a time material not to exceed basis, and select the quotes from contractors to perform the work that are most advantageous to La Crosse County.
Okay, that is the what is proposed as the substitute amendment. We kind of dumped this in the lap of Mr. Spiropoulos at executive committee last week, and I'm going to ask him to come forward and kind of tell us what has transpired since then before we enter into the discussion in this matter. And then people can also ask Jim any questions about the condition of the property and so forth. Terry Johnson.
Can we just clarify the procedure here? Is executive committee saw it after Public Works and Infrastructure and is, according to our ordinances, not allowed to make amendments in committee? That's why it's being done tonight. Just
thank
so
you for that clarification. If this were the originating committee having put this in, you wouldn't have two versions here. You'd only have this last one. Okay, Jim, can you bring us up to speed?
Sure. After the executive committee last week, I got several phone calls from area contractors, as well as I contacted some area contractors to take a look at it with us. I also had Vantage Architects down there with us. There are architectural firm on contract for small projects like this. We looked at the area, and the process that we're going to use to repair this is Vantage is going to do a scope of work statement along with a structural engineer, get it to the five area contractors that expressed interest, at least that day anyway, and get quotes in from them to take care of shoring up what we have down there. Instead of contracting with one contractor, executive felt it better to contact other contractors.
And not to say that it couldn't end up with Market and Johnson.
Could end up with them again, but it's putting it out there for all of them to look at.
Brad Paff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jim, if I may ask, where did the $150,000 to $200,000 come from?
It came from budget estimates from Market and Johnson.
Okay.
An estimate from immediate response abatement for the asbestos portion. I put some dollars in there for taking the equipment that's in there out, the false floor that's in there, and then a contingency. So it came from three different entities.
So we can expect that those five contractors, if they do have interest, one could assume that they're going to come in below $200,000 in between.
One would assume they'd all come in well below the $200,000.
I would hope. The other question, and it's maybe a very small question, but I first heard about this in the La Crosse Tribune when I saw the picture. How'd that come about? I mean, how did the Tribune get a picture? Did someone call over and say, oh, my God, you need to see this hole in the floor? How did that happen?
From the committee agendas, they contacted myself, and I took them down there, and they took pictures. So,
Ann Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I read in here someplace where this fix would last approximately 5 years. Is that true, this temporary fix?
Well, we're not anticipating replacing the floor. We're anticipating putting shoring up to hold the floor up.
But it would last like 5 years?
Right. We're not trying to stop what's spreading. We're trying to just keep it in place.
That just doesn't make sense to me that we would spend like $200,000 for a temporary fix. I mean, 5 years is not a very long time. I just don't see why we don't fix it and be done with it. I cannot believe that we're thinking, you know, within the next 5 years of doing something with this building the way the economy is right now. So I would like to see a more permanent fix.
Danvina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I read through this and looked at it, I guess I got a whole bunch of steel posts that are adjustable, and all you need is something of a platform underneath so it doesn't fall through. If we're going to spend $200,000 to fix the floor on a temporary basis and not spend the $350,000 to do it permanently, we are crazy. I agree with Ann Fisher totally on this one, because $200,000 is a lot of money, or even $150,000 is a lot of money if you're going to only do it on a temporary basis. If you're going to do it, do it. I looked at it on a tour about 3 or 4 years ago. You took me through, and yes, it is deteriorating, and yes, it is falling through, and it should have been fixed 2 or 3 or 4 years ago, but nobody did that. Jim, I don't know why we didn't do that 2 or 3 years ago, when we were in better financial situation than we are today. But I will not be voting for $150,000 to $200,000 to do it temporarily when we can do the whole thing for $350,000. I don't care where you borrow the money from, but we're building a new brand new jail. Let's bring some of those shoring things over and put studs up and a temporary floor over, and I can help volunteer to put that up there if you need something done by a farmer from the area. So.
Well, that's why we wanted to open it up beyond Market and Johnson, so that Bina Stabilization Services could submit a quote on this one. So contact his office. Jeff Schrader.
Thank you. I won't bang on the drums here any longer, but I too, all feel that this is a waste of taxpayers' money to spend $200,000 on a short-term fix. I think you should, my feeling is, get the same proposals from guys to fix it for the long term. So is now the time to make an amendment to this thing, or when would I do that?
I would say that the better route, if you don't want to do this, is to simply vote it down, because this says we're not going to... Just a second, let me finish, Jeff.
Okay.
What this resolution says is we're going to go outside of the normal procedure of getting bids.
Right.
If you're going to do a permanent thing, I think that that would be looked at as a different procedure, perhaps. And so, I mean, you can do it how you want. I would say the better procedure, vote it down, and next month the board could come in and vote on a proposal to do the permanent thing. Bill, do you have any comments on how we should?
Well,
The only reason that you can do it this way is if you declare this to be an emergency, and the longer that you delay it, it doesn't look like much of an emergency. I think that the issue is, do you, in your mind, believe that this is an emergency because of the prospect or the imminent danger that the floor will collapse, send cancerous types of particles into the air that will affect the every person in this building?
But can I finish?
You got the floor.
Okay, I understand that. I want to fix it, but I do think it needs to be fixed permanently, not a Band-Aid put on it. And so can I make a motion that we go out for proposals? I don't think that's against the rules to go out for proposals to fix it for the long term versus the short term.
Certainly within the parliamentary rules, you could do that. However, I'm going to ask Jim to address this, what it would take. He's brought in contractors to look at a temporary fix. He hasn't brought in contractors to look at a permanent fix, right?
Correct.
So I think that's really the problem, where just turning on a dime is not the way to do it. Vote it down if you don't want to do this, and we'll come back with something different. Is that kind of where you're coming from, Jim?
If you're not going to do a temporary fix, then I don't think a time and material basis is the right answer for this. If you want the floor fixed back to its original state, I think we do a complete design bid process.
Well, I don't know if it needs to be fixed to its original state, because it probably won't be housing any vehicles anymore. Am I correct?
Correct. Back to a state where it's usable.
Right.
I guess that's what I meant, but yeah.
So you feel you would have to go out for a bid on that? Or you just wouldn't be able to do it for proposals?
Correct.
From proposals?
Yeah,
well, somebody must have given you some figures here.
They put a budget number together is all they did.
Yeah, and that's...
And to do a full-blown replacement on a time and material basis, I would recommend against that. There is too many moving parts to it to do it that way. I think a complete spec and bid process is more prudent.
All right. And also, I guess I kind of question whether it's a dire emergency, because this has gone on for 4 years and there wasn't anything declared. So I wish I knew which way to do this. I guess I would I want it fixed, and I don't want to delay it for any significant amount of time. So I guess I'll make a I'll make a motion that we go for the long-term fix versus the short-term fix for $200,000. I make a motion that we go and receive bids, that Jim go out and get bids for a permanent fix to this rather than for a short-term fix. That's an amendment to the... I know it's not...
Well, Bill is saying that we can't do that.
That we can't do what?
I assume you're saying along the lines of germaneness, is that, or...
I think that you need. I think that you need to vote on the substitute amendment first, and then decide where you're going to go from there. So, that's a majority vote only.
Is that if we vote on the substitute amendment, we're spending money, right?
No.
If it gets voted down, then you're not. Then something would come back next month.
Then you're still back on the original.
Well, you're back on the original one, but the original one is still the temporary fix. So if you vote the substitute down, I assume you're going to vote down the original. I mean, they're kind of part and parcel, the same idea there. So if you want to do the permanent fix, you vote the whole works down today. If you want to do the temporary fix, you vote either the substitute amendment, or if you want to just strictly go with Market and Johnson, that's fine, too. You'd vote for the original. Those are your options. I don't think... procedurally, we can do the shift from time and materials to go into the bidding process. I think we need a new resolution and do that process as we normally do the bidding process.
Is that correct, Bill?
Yes, I think that's correct.
All right, Terry Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to explain. I was the lone no vote in executive committee on the original resolution because I thought that this substitute resolution was more prudent. And I just want to be very clear that I support the work of Public Works and Infrastructure. I think they have been dealing with this issue for quite a while. Their rationale and their logic for taking the approach of the temporary fix makes sense to me. And were it not for the exclusive contracting with a single contractor locally, I would have supported the original resolution. So I am happy to see the replacement amend or the replacement resolution in here, and I encourage everybody to support it.
Let me tell you who's on the list, and if you're interested in talking, but I don't have you on the list, it means I didn't see your hand. And here's the order that I have people. Don Meyer, Bridget Flood, Tom Rauch, Brad Conkle, Jim Burns, Ralph Geary, Joe Belskemper, Joe Veenstra. Is there anybody? Okay, we'll put Ray Ebert on, Jerry Sobranek, Vicki Burke. Anybody else? And Marilyn Pedretti. Okay, if as we go along, if other people want to talk, just raise your hand, but we'll do it in the order that I just read, starting with Don Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Either Steve or Jim, there's been several questions as to why we're doing it on a Band-Aid type deal or just doing part of it. You want to get into the long-range future of the campus committee as to why we really don't know what's going to happen to this building in the future anyway. Well, you want to explain that?
Thank you, Don. That's what we tried to include in the packet, and we thought most supervisors understood our background on it. You can obviously disagree with our conclusion. About 2 months ago, I presented that the issue of trying to deal with the long-term viability of this building and the campus plan, given our current tax situation and the equalized value tax base of the entire county, indicated to me as your administrator that it's not prudent to make a long-term decision about this building. We included in your packet a range of options, which includes everything from doing nothing and taking a chance that it will keep lasting, do full replacement, traditional procurement, or our staff recommendation. Attached to that is the one-page summary from the Venture Architects campus master plan, which compares that the cost comparison between remodeling or building new is that it's a little bit more expensive, several million dollars to build new than to remodel. However, they go on to make additional points that there may be efficiencies in restructuring the if you build new, there may be other benefits because you also have to disrupt the entire county operation if you remodel and everybody stays in this building, but that it's very clear that this board and this administration have not come to a conclusion, nor are we likely to come to a conclusion in the next 4 to 5 years about what to do with this building long term. It seems imprudent to spend at least $350,000. We've had other estimates that were higher than that initially to replace a floor that we don't know if we're going to stay in this building. That's why we've recommended. We do not expect to spend $150,000 to $200,000 for the temporary solution. By doing time and materials, when we remodeled the existing female jail, it came in well under what our highest estimates had been. I'd ask Jim to explain exactly how we did a much smaller remodeling project in the women's jail, that by doing time and materials managed by us, it's not given to one contractor. Jim's the general contractor, and he uses various people to make sure that what you're getting into is a very difficult situation. Let me describe what's there for those of you that haven't seen it. And this is from a layperson, but as a manager, when you look at that and you end up having to tear out the two false ceilings, you don't know how far that rust has gone back. Any contractor worth their own salt is going to want to tear all that back, see what he or she has, and then have to dig into it to find out how far the rust went back. You won't know until you do that. That's why this is a true time of materials. If you disagree and you want to do the whole project, then you got to do it right bid from start, because you're going to have to tear it all the way back. And then you'll get a bid spec and that type of thing. We thought this was the most prudent. We honestly don't believe it will go as high as 200, but we don't know either. Market and Johnson didn't know, that helped us actually put these numbers together. The fact is you need to have somebody on our behalf actually manage that. We did the best we could. You still have to make that evaluation. There's a two-thirds vote required of this. We'll go back to the drawing board and take your direction. None of us has a crystal ball on this. fact is, we've been waiting year after year trying to come up with a long-term solution for this building. If anybody disagrees with me that we're ready to make a long-term solution for this building, I don't believe we are. And it's your judgment. Is it better to make a permanent solution that you may not stay in the building anyway, or do a temporary solution and see where this body is at 4 years? That's why that's our best recommendation. I respect however the board deals with this issue. These are not always easy issues, but when you're dealing with remodeling of a bad situation, none of us knows until we tear that back, and the contractors will not know the structural soundness. And if they're going to do the work, they're going to want to do it right, because obviously we're going to expect to have it done right. So this is not an easy solution, but it's still our best recommendation.
Would people have any interest in taking a 10-minute break and walking down the hall to look at it?
Yes.
Do people want to do that? Okay. Is there a motion to recess for 10 minutes? Moved by Bill Brockmiller, second by Jerry Sobranek. We're recessed for 10 minutes. Jim will do a guided tour. All right. We are back in session, and let's continue with the discussion, and that means that Bridget is up. If she passes, then Tom Roque is up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to try and pull some of these points back into focus a little bit. It may not be apparent to everyone that this particular discussion is a significantly small subset of the discussion that the campus plan committee would have had it gotten started, had economic conditions and realism about future budgets not derailed that process. And this, by agreement, was left as, we'll hold our breath as long as we can and put this off as long as we can and then deal with this as an urgent item when we had to. The thing that makes it an urgent item is, as much as anything else, the asbestos that's back there and around that, and you don't deal with the asbestos potential and contamination by just propping some boards up underneath that thing. And neither do you deal with the uncertainty of when that floor might collapse, somewhere between 2 days and 2 years, or maybe longer than that from now, and not a single person, including the Market and Johnson expert, would venture an opinion about that. And so that is entirely an unknown as to when that floor might come down. If it does, we have now had massive disruption to the electrical service in this building, communication service in this building, and Jim, I'm not sure, but I think computer communication service also, because it's via the same kind of wires. So it is that kind of uncertainty that lends the urgency and the credibility to calling this an emergency. If you disagree or doubt all of that, then we should defeat this whole proposal, the amendment and the original, because it's not an emergency, and we shouldn't be doing things as an emergency if they aren't. But then the follow-up to this is, and has been discussed well on both sides, as to whether this is appropriate for a short-term fix or whether it should be part of the long-term fix. And again, that campus plan committee and this full board would have dealt with that as a long-term fix after a lengthy process of reviewing alternatives, requirements, space needs elsewhere throughout this building, all the rest of the asbestos abatement that needed to take place in this building. And those kinds of really big two-digit million-dollar numbers are what are on that horizontal sheet at the end of the presentation for 13A. That's a lot of money, and it would have taken this board a long time to work its way through the process on agreeing to do all that money or not. So to isolate that particular portion of this building and saying, let's do the permanent fix, when the long-term solution here might be demolish this building and rebuild, makes an expensive solution still be temporary. And so if you don't want to do this $150,000 to $200,000 proposal alternative as a temporary fix, which, by the way, Mr. Spropoulos and I think and others have said those numbers are very generous. We're quite certain that we will not exceed those numbers, but see very little point to try and shave it down to 127 or whatever the other number might really be and then be forced to come back to this board for a little bit of a supplemental. That's kind of getting down into the silly business. And oh, by the way, his number where he states 350,000 says at least, and he's quite certain about that, and until, as Chairman Doyle mentioned, we have a true engineering requirement drafted for the contract and true pile of engineers in here to measure that in excruciating detail and make firm proposals, firm bids that they will live with. We don't know what that $350K number might be. It could be 500 or more, and it still might be something that we tear down in 3 to 5 years when the economy improves, the campus plan committee happens, and we can bond for the ultimate solution. So you really kind of have two things to decide here. Is it truly an emergency or not? Those of you who had seen it before or just now, is it truly an emergency or not? And do we need to do a short-term fix, or do we need to send this back to that full, long, laborious process to get the right answer for the whole solution to this building? And I'm going to vote for the amendment and for it as the solution to this when we get through discussing it. Thank you.
Brad Conkle.
I just wanted to say that initially I definitely was not in favor of this amendment here, but with discussion with Chairman Doyle and I think Steve made some really good points in here as well. I think it's important that we kind of consider how long this building's going to last us and look at the lifetime of what we have here. And, you know, this resolution here doesn't even give us a real approximation. It says it's going to cost possibly greater than $350,000 to permanently fix the floor. So, I mean, with the expectation that that's going to cost upwards, I think that it's worth, you know, spending hopefully on the lower end of this temporary fix, more towards that $150,000 figure, which we would obviously hope for. But I think it's definitely important to consider the longevity of the building, and I will definitely be voting for the resolution.
A question for Jim. You had said that there are various components that went into your estimate of the numbers. Can you isolate out approximately the cost of the asbestos, which would, whether we're doing temporary or long-term / permanent, that's an expense that we're going to have to pay, right?
Yes.
Okay, so what is that portion?
The verbal estimates that I got from immediate abatement, which is out of just across the river, to do the temporary, taking the two ceilings out, and cleaning some of the floor up where they're going to have to do the work is about $25,000. To do a more permanent would require taking it off all the beams down there, all the pipe fittings from the plumbing and that. He estimated around a budget number about $50,000.
Okay.
So that's kind of where we're at. And those are just real rough preliminary numbers that we would go into time and material.
Go ahead, Brad. You can follow up.
Just one follow-up thing is also, you know, we're doing 15 years out planning for the county farm. I think it's important to start addressing, you know, what's going to happen with some of the other county facilities and really start taking a close look at that. If we're planning 15 years out, there's nothing to say that we have to, you know, remodel or rebuild for an administrative building in the next 3 to 5 years. You know, I wouldn't be voting in favor of that either. I don't think that's wise to do it as soon as the economy turns around. But, you know, I could definitely foresee it in the next 10. And so that kind of comes to the point is this really a permanent fix or is it still temporary in that time frame? And so I think if we're talking upwards of $350,000, then, you know, look at the numbers and it'll be there. And it shows that we're better off doing the temporary fix.
Jim Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a county board supervisor, I don't believe I am qualified to determine whether or not this project is essentially an emergency or there's a large sense of urgency to get this project going. So I guess my question is, Mrs. Spiropoulos, what went into your determination regarding this issue in terms of your declaration that it's an emergency and it's an urgent matter that we need to address now?
One of the reasons that the campus committee or the campus study was actually formed was this was one of those parts of the puzzle, was the deteriorating floor, the roof replacement that we need to do, all of the plumbing issues, electrical issues that we experience. That's why we did the campus study, was to evaluate this building and the whole campus. since that's been put on the shelf for a while, we have to deal with some of these issues, and this is one of the major issues. Can I tell you that that floor is going to stay up 4 or 5 more years? I can't. And I think Mr. Rock was right. Nobody can.
So it sounds like the part of the emergency or urgency is the unknown of the structure itself. And so I guess my question is this. If we're not sure what the state of the structure is there any way we can have our architect come in and do an evaluation before we take that next step? Maybe the evaluation is that the structure is more sound than we think. Maybe the evaluation is we need to do something tomorrow. But I guess until we get that evaluation, shouldn't we wait and get that evaluation first? I guess that's my question.
I don't think you can really get to that point until you get the ceilings out so you can evaluate the whole thing. And that's where the range of numbers comes in, the 150 to 2. We don't know how much shoring is going to be required. We can't get at all the areas with the two ceilings that are there.
So what would it cost to just to get an evaluation of the state of the condition of the structure? What would that time and cost? What would that be to get these? Because there's a lot of unknowns. And I feel that that's kind of part of the reason why there's urgency is we don't know what the state is. So what would it take to get that information?
I would say between that 25 and 50,000 range.
25 and 50,000.
So we have to do the abatement just to get to it, and then there's going to have to be some analysis on the structure to see how sound it is.
So is it an option then to approve you said the abatement and the analysis as a first step, and then after that we can proceed to something more costly or less costly based on what we see? Is that would you say that's a possibility?
Yeah, that's a possibility, but keep in mind the whole intent of this resolution is declaring an emergency so it doesn't take us long to do the full-blown bid spec process.
Sure.
And we don't know. We don't know how far back it goes.
How long would it take if you wanted to do like the abatement and analysis? How long would that take to do the RFPs, to get that done? Could we fast track that? I mean, could that be the first thing we do and we get that done with? And can we prove that tonight?
Can I ask Mr. O'Malley to jump in at this point? Because he was present during a portion of some discussion here that I think is very relevant to exactly the question you're asking there, Jim.
When we started this plan, we had obviously our first architect look at it, and they had recognized that this is a severe problem. That's when we first started the campus plan. As we kept saying, we're not going to be able to do this whole building, we talked to Market and Johnson just because they're the CM. They didn't charge us anything for it because they're already working on the project. We said, well, you guys deal with this. You'd be a potential candidate for doing it. We met with Market and Johnson, Don Carlson, who you all know, who's worked on this. And his first reaction, well, I'm sure this is a small project. It's no big deal. There's not going to be anything we really need to be concerned about. We brought him down there, and he looked at it. And the more he looked at it and the uncertainty, he's going, this is a serious problem. This needs to be dealt with. Now whether Market and Johnson gets the work, I think he'd actually probably be pleased that he doesn't. The other contractors that have looked at it, they were real interested before they saw it. Whether or not they submit a bid, I guess we'll see. The point is that nobody, until you tear all that back, and once you start tearing it back, as you just saw, you don't know what you get into. You may start damaging the structural integrity of it by just tearing off the stuff you're tearing off. You know, none of us has a crystal ball. That's what I said earlier. This is a judgment call. But we've thought this is going to last, and heck, this was on my plate when I first came here 6 years ago, and we said, well, we got to get to that. Well, at some point with the electrical, the computer, the phone, and the heating and ventilating system, that all, once that asbestos becomes airborne, then we've got another problem. It's not prudent. Whichever decision you make, I respect. but we believe that we can do it more cost-effectively on a temporary basis. And I did ask one point that Jim, I don't believe, had a chance to comment. When we did the female jail remodeling just recently, we did it time and materials, and it came in substantially less than our estimate, because once you have your facilities director managing a time and materials, it doesn't go any further. And contractors don't have to protect themselves by overbidding. If you're a contractor, you're not going to low bid this, right? You want to cover yourself until you get into it. That's why time and materials is the best way to do it, unless you only believe in a permanent solution. But even then, they're going to bid high, because until they tear it out, they don't know what they've got into. So ultimately, it's still our feedback from a guy that does this, manages contracts for a living, everything from remodeling to building, said this is way more serious than he thought it was when we first described it, and that the uncertainty is what really concerned him, as has been concerning us, being the responsible parties for this building.
Okay, so that helps me with my first question, and that is, where did this sense of urgency come from? And it sounds like somebody, Mr. Carlson, looked at it, and on his estimation, he's concerned. And like I said, I'm not at liberty to determine the urgency of the project. That's not my qualifications, and so that's why I'm looking for some rationale and support for going through with this project. Thank you.
Let me just follow up one more thing. As your administrator, I am very concerned about the integrity of the health in this building because of the asbestos, and I'm not an engineer. I'm not qualified to do that, but I'm concerned about the longevity of the power, the phone, the electrical, and the air quality in this building. It's been something we've been concerned about for quite a while, and I've got no evidence that that's going to last for any long length of time, and that's not a good situation to be in. And I'm no more of an engineer than you are. I'm just concerned about the public that come to this building and the employees that work here.
Okay, Ralph Geary.
Thank you. The reason it was brought in as an emergency is it allows us to do what they want to do. This isn't an emergency. When you know about something for 6 years, I sit on the committee. Jim last year didn't say, if we don't do something within a year, this is going to turn into an emergency. January, did he tell us this was an emergency? No. February, it wasn't an emergency. March, I go to the committee meeting. We don't even discuss it. April, wasn't an emergency. Suddenly in May, it's an emergency. Something we know about for 6 years. So is it an emergency? No. But by statute, because they refer to a statute, it allows you to do something this way. What happens if you turn it down? You could have another resolution here on June 8th at the policy planning meeting, 18 days. We waited on it 6 years. Can we wait 18 days to vote on another resolution in regard to the asbestos removal? Well, it's $25,000 if we do it temporary. It might be $50,000 if it's permanent. Sooner or later, you're going to have to remove it anyway. So it's that $50,000 is going to be spent if it's 25 and 25 or 50 at a crack. But on the resolution, I didn't understand one thing. Were people paying the prevailing wage rate? It didn't make mention to that. A lot of jobs we pay that. Are we paying prevailing wage rates?
I don't think we'll hit the limit for that.
Okay, and by area contractors, does that mean they have to reside in La Crosse County?
No.
Oh, okay. So then why did
we've contacted area contractors.
Oh, okay.
And if others...
It made mention to it, so I didn't know if that meant La Crosse County. So my thing is, if you bid it out, you can get both the temporary solution, the permanent solution, and you can accept or reject all bids. I don't want to speculate if this is $350,000, $500,000, $200,000, whatever. But by getting the bids, you'll have apples to apples, oranges to oranges, and you'll know what you're doing. But to call this an emergency, when I sit on the committee, we never even discussed it up till May that it was the emergency. We were aware of the problem. If you're looking at it for the first time, it may look like an emergency. If you'd been watching it over a number of years, you don't notice a big a difference.
Joe Bilskemper. Joe Veenstra.
I guess the, I sort of am echoing the concerns stated by Supervisor Geary that the idea that this is an, I feel like we've been put in a position where if we vote against this resolution or the amendment, that we're saying we want to put county employees at risk of having asbestos in their lungs and having the electricity get knocked out in the whole building. And I do think that perhaps if there's any concern whatsoever about the structural soundness of the building in any location that the county, any building the county owns whatsoever, that it should be addressed immediately instead of putting us in a position where we have to feel like if we want to get a bid on a permanent solution that we're somehow risking the lives and safety of other people. I think that's a little unfair to put us in that position. Also, I mean, if it was became an emergency because Mr. Carlson looked at it and said, this is an emergency, I appreciate that, but perhaps it should have been analyzed earlier, and I say that with due respect. I mean, I think everyone tries to do the right thing, but this is, puts us in a very difficult position. And then also this vote is somewhat tangentially being tied to the idea of either we're going to have some sort of, it has some connection to a larger plan for this building as in total. Who knows? If it's going to cost us temporarily in the next 10 years three times $150,000 to do temporary fixes, and the permanent fix at, with a bid is going to cost $280,000, you can see what the what makes more sense. We have some guarantee that it's going to last 5 years as a temporary fix? Probably not. You know, it's just a really kind of an unfair position to be put in. However, you know, I don't want anybody breathing asbestos, and I don't want the whole electrical soundness of the building caving in either. So it's a terrible position to be in to try and vote on something like this.
Ray Ebert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I guess I share the thing is if 30 days ago it was not an emergency and now it is, that just doesn't make sense to me. One question, if we do the temporary fix, then will you be able to use that building for your equipment and stuff? Where if we do a permanent, you would, correct?
If we do the temporary fix, we do still do not intend to use the space above or below that. Okay. That floor.
Because I understand the garage that we built, you have a lot of stuff in there, and it would be, and the sheriff's department is still using stuff at Lakeview and stuff. So if we could get a permanent fix, move a lot of your stuff back into that garage, if it's a permanent fix, correct?
Right. The main part of the people that went down there to look at saw was where printing used to be.
No, I saw, I agree that right. It needs work, because you showed me, I was
right. That the part that's that. Bad is not where the two garage doors are currently. It's where printing was relocated in 97. Okay. So there was no equipment in there.
Correct.
But after 97.
Are you going to, could you use the garages if they fix them then to put your stuff in?
There are no garage, the doors are gone. There are no garage doors coming into that area anymore.
Okay. Is it blanked in or something?
Yeah.
Okay, so you could put garage doors in there and use it again.
If you brought it back to that permanent fix, yes.
Correct. Yeah, the sheriff and yeah, I mean we spent $20,000 to decide to find out what a price on the Hillview was. I'm certainly for getting a estimate so we can for both a permanent and a temporary. And again, I'm going to vote against this and hope that you'll bring back a amendment or a resolution that we can go out and get legitimate bids both for temporary and permanent. Thank you, sir.
Jerry Sobranek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Supervisor Rauch expressed my opinions very well. However, we know that nothing lasts forever. When these buildings are built, they have a life expectancy. Given the fact that you're gonna be facing a continual degradation of the structural integrity of the building, you're talking to me. Any amount that you decide here tonight or postpone is temporary. The only permanent cost is it seems to be talking 4 or 5 years down the road. And as this building deteriorates, I hear the talk of the thing in the newspaper when they show the picture that we're talking 4 or 5 years. We're going to have to tear that down, tear this building down. That is a permanent fix. I would support the lesser amount and fix things as we go until we get to that point, because it is something we're going to have to address in the very near future, which is 4 to 5 years from what the estimates seem to be. Thank you.
Vicki Burke.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It just seems to be very reasonably that we would accept the first resolution. And the reason why I say that is because truly, I believe it is an emergency, and that it seems to me the most practical thing would be not to ask to take time to do quotes when the most advantageous would be to use Market and Johnson, who is there presently on site, and I think that would be most advantageous to us as far as expense and to doing the particular job. So I supported the original resolution and would continue to support it.
Marilyn Pedretti.
A little further on the space utilization. If you do the shoring up, you wouldn't be able to use the space upstairs. What about the space downstairs?
It's currently not used now, and we would continue.
There's
that.
Not a space shortage in this building?
We always have a space shortage, but just shoring it up, we still don't feel we should use the space either above or below.
All right, and if you did the full replacement, is that taking out the cement and placing it with, like, wood beams, subflooring? It would be replacing it with cement again?
We would replace it as it is now.
Because?
With a poured-in-place concrete floor.
Is that how the rest of the building is?
Yes.
That's not just because it was a garage.
Right. Putting on a wood floor would not fit the City of La Crosse's ordinance for downtown construction.
Thank you. And then my third question. The full bid process, how long does something like that take?
Off the top of my head, probably 60 to 90 days to do design work if we got them going on it right away. Another 30 to 60 days to bid it out. 6 months, I could probably bring something back, hopefully, for this body to approve.
My only other comment is that the asbestos really concerns me. I would like to see doing the whole thing and taking out all the asbestos now. I mean, 25,000 versus 50,000, take care of it and be done. That's all.
Andrea Richmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with the last speakers, but I think there's a question on what we are doing here this evening. The cost could be a lot higher if, in fact, there are air quality issues, and there could be as we're debating this. It takes 25 to 30 years before serious health issues are diagnosed with asbestos problems. I recently had a friend diagnosed with asbestos problems, and it is not a good situation. We need to act now. We need to move forward. I would like to move the question to get this temporary solution treated as an emergency basis. So I call that question.
Second.
Thank you.
Second.
There is one person who has not spoken for the first time yet. I'm going to give him a chance to do that before we take that motion. That's Don Bina. Everybody else that I have on the list has spoken once before. Mr. Bina, you have not on this issue.
I thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to point out a number of things. When we moved the judge's chambers over to the other building, we did take out some asbestos out of some of the upstairs in here, and I'm not sure to what extent. Asbestos is all through the whole building. And I'll have you know that the FSA committee, which was down in the basement here, moved out because the federal guidelines for the federal agencies say that there shall not be a government agency in the building that has asbestos. So they did move out because of that. So if you're assuming that the useful life of this building is only 5 years, maybe you want to do something temporary, but this building is only, 60 years old? And that's not too bad for a downtown building, and they should... Well, anyhow, you can replace them at any time, but if you guys got the money to replace it, go ahead. But if you're going to fix it, do it right, and maybe you're not going to move out of here in 5 years from now.
And by the way, my mistake, Mr. Bina had in fact already spoken. He had volunteered to bid on this project, in fact. So, all right. Andrea Richmond moves to close debate. Is there a second on that? Second by Brad Conkle to close debate. All in favor of closing debate, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The noes, please raise your hand. The noes are Ray Ebert, Maureen Friedland, Ralph Geary, Ann Fisher, and Jeff Schrader. I believe, though, that that was still enough to close debate, so debate is closed. You will vote on the computer on the substitute amendment, which is that it's not specifically limited to Market and Johnson. It would be to get quotes from local contractors. Mr. Roque, do you have a point of order or something?
Point of information. This vote only requires a simple majority. The vote on either the substitute or the original amendment to pass requires the two-thirds.
That is correct. This is simply an amendment to change the original proposal. After this vote, we will then vote on the resolution, presumably as amended, if this passes, to change from Market and Johnson to local contractors. People clear on that? Okay, so if you are in favor of saying local contractors rather than Market and Johnson, vote yes. If you want it to be just Market and Johnson, vote no. The next vote then would be whether we go with this tonight or do something different. Thank you for that clarification, Mr. Oak. Again, this is simply on the amendment.
Mr. Shepard,
Mr. Chair,
yeah. Point of information, is that how we do a substitute amendment? I thought we took the whole. I thought we were substituting the entire text.
We are,
because
there's only a few relevant lines, but he is substituting the entire text for what was there before. Much of it is simply a duplication.
Okay, so we still have to take a second vote.
Yes. Purely look at this as an amendment. Forget the word substitute. It's much easier to analyze this as an amendment. Then the big issue is the next vote. All right, the amendment has passed on a vote of 23-7, including Leon's vote. So now we are on the resolution as amended. So ignore what the first resolution was. We are purely on that second version. If you are in favor of that, vote yes. If you are opposed to that, vote no. Is that clear for people? Tom Roque? And this requires two-thirds vote.
Just a point of information. Have we terminated discussion or debate on that particular? We just called the question on the amendment.
People could continue to debate. Sure. If there's debate, we can. Otherwise, we'll vote. As soon as our computer is working. By the way, we do have a work group investigating the voting system for down here because of these kinds of issues. All right. Is that ready to go? We're voting. Yeah, there weren't any hands up, so we're voting. Okay, if you are in favor of the resolution as amended, vote yes on the computer. If you are opposed, vote no. Actually, I just noticed that everything we've done for the last 3 hours doesn't matter because under the result for the roll call, it says failed. So we're really not here tonight. So we would like you to all surrender your checks for tonight. Tammy, we're still waiting for yours. We have, adding Leon's vote, we have 20 yes, 10 no, which in fact would be two-thirds. I don't think it's two-thirds of, is it of the full board, not two-thirds of... Oh, so it's two-thirds of the full board, not just members present? Okay, so that fails then. I will ask staff to come up with Plan B, and we'll either have this on the planning meeting in early June or else county board in June.
Mr. Chair, could I move to refer to a committee, which would be before the...
It will go. It'll start in Public Works and Executive. Yeah, it will. Okay. Mr. Spiker, I guess we're still with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Item 14-5, approval of mobile home disposal fees and policy. Whereas the Solid Waste Department has proposed a policy for mobile home disposal that will provide service to customers, maintain all Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, La Crosse County policies, and site safety, maintain revenue by charge, changing user fees, and ensure that these will be no interruption in the daily routine waste hauling. Whereas the mobile home disposal policy requires pre-disposal procedures that include DNR inspection on all mobile homes coming from business and require evidence that an asbestos inspection was performed and all non-friendable and friendable asbestos was removed prior to disposal in compliance with DNR requirements. Whereas the requirement for asbestos removal is optional for individual mobile home owners. But if private mobile home owner suspects asbestos is present, is recommended the mobile home shall be tested and asbestos properly removed. Whereas the Solid Waste Department policy for mobile home disposal also includes the following requirements. Provide a copy of title of ownership, remove all thermostats or related devices from the home that contain mercury and remove the fluorescent light ballast which may contain PCBs. Remove all appliances, compressed gas, flammable tanks, water heaters, or furnaces. Call the Solid Waste Department at least one day before delivery of mobile home for disposal after meeting the above-mentioned requirements. Whereas the fees for mobile home disposal are set forth in the attached addendum to the comprehensive master list, and such fees attempt to fairly allocate the full cost of services to the users of those services. Now, therefore, be resolved that La Crosse County Board does hereby approve the establishment of mobile home disposal policy by the Solid Waste Department that meets the above requirements and does further approve the user fees for such services as set forth on the addendum to the comprehensive master list attached here to Exhibit A to be effective commencing May 21st, 2009. Fiscal notes, the following revenue and fixed costs for the mobile home disposal 2009 are estimated as to as follows. Construction and demolition homes, revenues, 8 homes, $400 a home, $3,200. Fixed costs, $400 municipal solid waste homes, revenue, 2 homes, $900 home, $1,800 total. Fixed cost, $900. Estimated net revenue for disposal of 10 mobile homes in 2009 is $3,700. Net revenue may increase if mobile homes are delivered from the outside of the system. I move for approval, Mr. Chairman.
Moved by Mr. Spiker, second by Mr. Leon Paff. Discussion or questions? Maureen Friedland.
I'd like to talk a little bit more about asbestos removal, with due respect. I see that it's a DNR requirement that businesses remove asbestos from mobile homes, and it's optional for individuals who own mobile homes. Now, could we have a steeper requirement? That could we require individuals to remove the asbestos before this is disposed of, or could we at least require them to be tested so we know whether there's asbestos in the amount and maybe work with these people to do removal. I'm wondering how much of a problem the asbestos is. What's going to happen to the landfill if we do that? And I'm also wondering about the predisposal procedure, the owner requirements that say that the individual owner would be exempt if they provide a title showing it's privately owned and not owned by a business or a mobile park. Now, it seems to me that it would be entirely conceivable that a business or a mobile home park could sell the mobile home to someone the day before they want to dispose of it. Could we have a steeper requirement than that? And would it be to our advantage to do that?
Well, Hank, you've been on board for I don't know how many days. You're going to get this one. Unless Denny has a better answer.
If I understand your question, one thing I guess with the landfill, we do take asbestos, both friable and non-friable, in the landfill already. And so the intent here is that these trailers are going to be disposed of in the areas where we are taking asbestos and demolition materials. We're trying not to make this onerous on the homeowner, but on the businesses we feel that they can afford to do this.
Did that answer your question?
You don't think it would be advantageous for us to try to get the asbestos out before it goes into the landfill? Does it make any difference because we're already taking asbestos? Is that's what your answer to the question is, right?
Exactly. Okay. It's the landfill does take asbestos. We are licensed and approved to dispose of that material. Again, we're trying not to make this onerous on homeowners, but we're trying to make businesses who may have a number of these mobile homes take a higher level of responsibility.
Okay, and you don't have any concerns that businesses would just retitle to individuals so that businesses would get out of their obligation?
We'll keep our eye on that, but I'm not concerned that's going to happen.
Don Meyer.
Changing the title would require us paying sales tax, and you'd have to establish a value, and it would cost a lot of money to do that. I mean, I can't imagine anybody doing it. They just said, well, do it for a dollar. The state would come back and say, oh, I think it's worth more than a dollar. So there'd be a big cost involved in doing that.
I think that's a good point. Jeff Schrader.
What is friable and non-friable?
Airborne or not.
Which one's which?
Friable is airborne. This is the one you worry more about. Non-friable, it's pretty firm. It doesn't rub off and get into the air easily.
Other questions or discussion? Mr. Ebert.
Yes, and on the rates it talks about $200 landfill operator special handling cost attached body anchors from frame moved to proper site, separate body from frame, cut frame, dispose, asterisk. Required to do work after hours or weekends. What? I don't understand.
When you decommission a mobile home, you need an area to do it in. We need to do that in the landfill. We can't do it at the same time our customers are in there. We just don't have enough room. It would present a potential danger to our customers. The other alternative is that the DNR would require us to develop a whole separate pad, which would be a large financial requirement. And so we have talked to our operator. He's agreeable to do this after hours or on the weekend. That minimizes the disruption to our customers, and so we think this is a good way to go.
Okay, I just want, this is not our employees doing this after hours or weekend, correct?
Absolutely not.
That would be a good idea. Thank you.
Other discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried unanimously. Mr. Spiker, I think you have one more.
One more, and this one's good news for the good to end on good news. We save money here. Item number 15-5, the committee met at 5:30 today and approved this unanimously. Approval for bid for Phase 2 Miler one-liner construction, old landfill grading and leachate extraction system. Whereas there is need for construction of a next lined landfill area, grading of the old landfill area, and the installation of leachate extraction system. Whereas La Crosse County has requested bids for construction of the landfill liner, grading of all the old landfill, installation of the leachate extraction system, and whereas sealed bids were received and public opened on May 7, 2009, whereas such bids have been reviewed for qualification of bidders and cost by Public Works and Structure Committee, whereas these construction projects were included in the La Crosse County 2009 Solid Waste Department budget. Now, therefore, be resolved that the La Crosse County Board does hereby approve a bid of $1,091,413,000 by Vet Company Incorporated for Project A-09-2009 Phase 7 of the Modular One-Liner Old Landfill Grading Leachate Extraction System. Be it further resolved, the County Board Chair is hereby authorized to execute any agreements to accomplish said work in accordance with specifications and the bid submitted, after approval by the Corporation Council. Fiscal note, funds for the project are budgeted in landfill renovation org 6510 earthwork construction account 64106. I move for approval, Mr. Chairman. I would like to retain the floor.
Moved by Mr. Spiker, second by Mr. Schrader. Mr. Spiker.
VIT Company is out of Rochester, Minnesota. They have done work for us previously, and Hank pointed out that they had no change orders, which is something in this area. But not only that, it saves us approximately $1 million from what we budgeted in 2009 budget. So I'm glad to end on good news. Thank you.
Could we use that $1 million to fix a floor?
No.
All right. Discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried unanimously. That it for you then, Mr. Spiker?
That's it.
Thank you, sir. Items for future agendas or announcements? Jill Billings.
Thank you. I would give you another kindly reminder that we have Day in the Life sign-up sheets out in the outer areas. Please join us and learn about the services that are important and that you're going to have to make difficult decisions on in the near future.
Anybody else? Jill Veenstra.
I'd just like to wish the chair a happy birthday.
Thank you. Yes, I'm old enough to drink now. And ready to do it. Any further discussion? Mr. Kyle, I think, has a motion. Move to adjourn by Mr. Kyle, second by Mr. Sobranek. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried unanimously. We're adjourned.